All right, folks, we are back on the Flagstick.com Team Talk podcast. This episode this week is going to be the looper episode. We have Scott Martin, longtime PGA Tour looper, Champions Tour looper, kind of went all over. And we have a lot of stories from caddies all over the world and some of our own. But before we get to that, I got to introduce my guest, my permanent guest on the podcast, Scott McLeod.
How are you doing, bud?
Welcome to the show.
Gee, first time, long time.
Yeah, every week we have you on as a guest.
It seems to be.
One day we might consider adding you full time, put you in the
that would be great.
Show notes. But we'll have to look at your performance. This might be a tale this week. How are you, though?
I'm doing all right. I was going to bug you in the fact that, you know, I'm a very happy boy at this time of year because my mom sends her Christmas package, including peanut brittle. But obviously, I know you have a deathly peanut allergy, so I'm not going to tease you with that.
Yeah,
but I will tell you,
you're just
really,
going to bring
really
it up
good.
Again.
I'm going to bring it up again anyways, because it's awesome. And, you know, it's that time of year. We're getting closer to the holiday season. So, it's all good.
Fair enough. I'm so happy for you. All right. What do we want to talk about this week before we get to all of our caddy stories? And we have a ton. We have a ton that, you know, we're going to go back. We're going to go back this episode to our first episode where Dez told some funny stories on there. And I clipped our favorite one, which we're going to get to. And all these different stories and our favorites and like Kyle Peters and Martin Trainer sent one. And we got a lot of good stories coming in. So look forward to that.
Do.
But, you know, there was golf this weekend. I don't know if you really watched much of it. I'll tell you how much I watched. I watched the 18th hole and then the playoff. But I didn't even watch the first playoff. I only watched the second playoff where he, you know, what's his face? I don't even remember his name. Robert Streb won, hit it to like an inch. And even then, Kevin Kisner still made it interesting by nailing like a 12-footer for par, like almost an impossible up and down for par. And you know, Streb somehow wins this tournament. It seems there's a certain group of guys that keep winning these events. I think the story for me is like, both those two guys in this playoff, neither one of them hit it long. And have we given up on this long ball nonsense?
I don't think so. I think it was just a hot story for a while. But, I mean, we obviously have proven and we've talked about it, and the tour is proving it, that, you know, there's more than one way to get the golf ball in the hole and have the lowest score. But, yeah, obviously, Streb, second time winning this tournament, and is only his second win, and they've both been there. So I didn't watch a lot. I have to tell you the truth. You know what? I'm generally fairly busy up until this time of year. I'm still busy with a number of different things for the magazine and stuff, but I actually tried to take a whole weekend off.
Nice.
For a time.
No golf. So, didn't even hit any shots, nothing?
Well, I might have swung one or two in my garage, but I didn't hit any balls. I hear you might have.
Yeah, I went out and played. It was really funny because when it was probably like 6 degrees out, and it was decent, good walk out there. And it's funny, speaking of caddying, I carried my bag because my dad borrowed. I am part of the push cart mafia, but my dad borrowed my cart for some reason, never gave it back. So I carried my bag, and I was hungover to start. Like, it was not good. I almost threw up a couple times out there. It was just my buddy.
Literally, not just your golf game.
No,
right?
Like my golf game, I was unbelievable on the golf course. I'm not going to lie.
You found it. You're turning into a fall player. I mean, when we played at Smugs, you know, you had it going as far as the tee ball is concerned.
Oh, yeah. Tee ball was great. The greens were pretty bad. I lipped out for eagle on a hole. I felt great until I doubled 18, but whatever. Who really cares? I had already lost money at that point, so I was like, what does it matter at this point? But yeah, it was fun. Felt good to be out there. But
weird,
what I was saying
is this time of year.
Yeah, it was weird. So then the next day it snowed, so that was even weirder. But I'm carrying my own bag, which is a, you know, standard carry bag, and I have nothing in there really. And my hip flexors the next day were just burning. And I was just thinking like, boy, I don't know if I can go to Mexico if somebody calls because I can't.
Hey, it's a flat golf course, but still, yeah, you might be dying there. You might not make it.
Yeah, no, it was tough. That's for sure. But it was just fun to get out, and I can officially say I think that's the last loop this year, unless as I said, unless somebody calls me down to Mexico or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I think, you know, I think everybody's pretty much closing up shop as far as the golf season is concerned. We certainly got a lot out of it, but I think it's over except for, you know, hey, there's still some golf to watch. That's for sure.
Absolutely. I was actually watching a little bit of the European tour because this,
yeah,
this Wilco Nienaber was hitting 430-yard drives. Now, they're playing at some insane elevation.
1,800 feet, yeah. And the fairways were rolling a ton. Yeah. Mind you, he was still averaging 80 yards longer than everyone else.
Which is insane because you've never really heard of the guy too much. I saw some of his numbers from Marty Jurtsen on Twitter. 197 ball speed. Insane. Like, that's just nuts. This guy's...
Yeah.
And it does not look like it. It looks like... I'm trying to even come up with an example of a guy his swing looks like. Just very normal.
Looks like Larry Mize.
Yeah, he doesn't look like completely in balance and everything. It was crazy.
Yeah. If you want, you can actually go on YouTube and actually he has a track band system at home and he actually has a complete round of golf. He's playing Valderrama on his track band. And you can watch the whole thing. If you're really obsessed, I went and checked that out. Just some of it. I didn't watch all of it. That would be a little bit too much, but I just want to see his numbers, his swing, and get to know him a little bit more because I think obviously he's going to be around for a little bit longer.
Can you imagine, like, I'm trying to think if there's a player out there where I would watch their entire round of golf on their TrackMan.
Yeah, that's hard to say. That's actually a good question sometime. Like a top five, who would you watch?
I don't think I could.
Would it start with one player?
I don't even know if I could get one player where I actually enjoy doing that.
That takes a lot of commitment.
Yeah, it's track, man. Who really cares? Whatever. But yeah, this guy clearly hits bombs. It was cool to see. It was funny, though, because they are at elevation. Aaron Cockerell sent a post on his Instagram. He's like, can we play at elevation every week? And I think he hit it 309.
It's all relative.
Yeah, and and he's just like, you know, that's great for him too. And then we got, Wilco going 420 and on into a par five, just insane. Yeah, but
insane.
Yeah, solid finish for Aaron that week,
Yeah. T4, that's his best finish on the European tour. I mean, he'd had two T14s early in the year. Celtic Classic was one of them. And then just a couple weeks ago in Cyprus. So that's great progress for him. It's nice to see him going low. I think there was a 64 in there, which matched his lowest score so far on the European tour. So definitely some progress there. And he's playing the Dunhill Links Championship, or the Alfred Dunhill Championship. I always get confused. It's not the Dunhill Links Championship. That is in Scotland. This is the Alfred Dunhill Championship in South Africa this week. So he's got a couple of events left in South Africa to wrap up that tour down there.
Yeah. See, you shot me that message that he's playing, and this is how you wrote it, playing the Dunhill whatever at SA. So yeah. I thought St. Andrews. I was like, sweet, I watched St. Andrews. And then I was like, wait, or is it South Africa? And then I was just like, I don't actually care. And then I didn't look into it. But it's way worse that it's not in St. Andrews. However, it does look like it's pretty, like where they are, it looks pretty cool. And he was posting some photos. We were chatting back and forth, and we're trying to get him back on the podcast, or maybe get his girlfriend on the podcast, who's taking over full-time duties now as his daddy, and quit her job, and this is it for her. So I kind of want to get that story eventually. Before we get to all the caddy talk, the match three is this Friday. I don't even know if you can call it the match three. Tiger's not even playing in it.
I don't know.
We got Phil and Charles Barkley versus Steph Curry and Peyton Manning. Will you watch any of this?
Only by accident and maybe for a few highlights. I know it's, it's Thanksgiving in the US, and obviously this is sort of a replacement for entertainment for like the old Skins game that used to be on this weekend. Mm-hmm. But I think the more that they do these matches, the more it obviously, kind of dumbs it down. There's certainly going to be a segment of people that are going to watch it just for, the hilarity of maybe watching Charles Barkley fumble it all over the place, or maybe they're interested in see what Steph Curry does and the interaction that Phil has with these players. So it has a possibility to be entertaining, but I don't think I'll catch a lot of it. But I certainly love some of the prop bets and odds that are coming out there and what you can bet on. That'll make it interesting for some people.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll watch it or care too much, or I might bet somewhere just for fun. I think he hit it like you can watch this, all the highlights afterwards anyway. Yeah. And it's not worth my $20 or whatever. I'm sure you can find a stream somewhere, but pretty much the minute something funny happens, it shows up on Twitter anyway.
Yeah, I think in Canada, it's going to be on like CNN International. So, yeah, find that on your dial.
CNN International. Okay. Yeah.
CNN. But again,
do we
you're
get,
right.
Like, Trump in between, you know, talking about how he didn't win the election.
I have no
great
idea.
It would be great if Charles at the end, like he lost by like 30 and he was on CNN and he was like, nope, I won. I won it. I won it big.
maybe they'll have to certify the votes at the end or certify all the shots at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. yeah, I don't really care. We'll watch it when we watch it, but doesn't bring much.
I think the funny part will be, like you said, it's going to be the highlight reel. And I mean, you know, they're going to put together a highlight package just of Charles Barkley's bad shots. That's got to show up someplace. It's going to happen.
Claims and he's a new golfer. Claims he's a new golfer.
Yeah, we'll see. So, I mean, you know, if he is, that's fine. But, you know, he'll be talking some trash. So I guess that's what people will want to dial in for and listen to see. You know, Mickelson and Barkley, unfortunately, are playing together. So unless they're going to start chirping each other, I don't really think there's going to be a lot of quality chirps coming from Steph Curry and Manning.
I don't know. Peyton's sneaky. I think Peyton's going to be throwing some fire out there, but we'll get back to it next week.
Yeah,
we got a lot of caddy stories to get to.
We do.
You know, what was your first time caddying? I know you've done some, and it probably was a long time ago. Back then, did you have to actually put the dirt down for the guy to put his tee on?
Yeah, you had the a little bucket of water, and then you had some sand, and then you had to wet it down, and then make it into a tee. And yep. Yeah, not quite. You know what? I think the first caddying that I did was as a teenager, various guys at golf courses to help out at a club championship or an event where, the big players at the club or whatever were playing in a tournament and, they were going out for a playoff. They didn't have a caddy during the actual tournament itself, but instead of just walking along and watching it, hey, why don't you, be part of it and grab a bag and kind of help out or whatever. And I think that was kind of my first little bit taste of it. And then as far as, I guess bigger level caddying, we've talked about a number of different Canadian players and stuff on this podcast. And, I was good friends with young Matt McQuillan, who made the PGA Tour. And early on when he was a good amateur, I caddied for him at the Canadian Amateur. I'm not sure why I volunteered to do that. It was about 4,000 degrees at Credit Valley. This is when they're playing sometimes two matches in a day. Not smart to volunteer for that one. And then I caddied for him for a bit and a couple of things for the Canadian Tour early on when he was an amateur. And that sort of a couple of those things got me the bug, I guess. And then eventually that led to doing some stuff on Canadian Tour and LPGA. Haven't caddied yet on the PGA Tour, but I'd certainly like to give that a go at some point. I think it was supposed to happen this year, but I'll tell more about that next year when it does happen. How's that?
Yeah, COVID ruined that for you. I'll claim COVID ruined my caddy career too. It's not the fact that I'm just a mediocre caddy at best. It was COVID. Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
that's why
yeah.
The phone isn't ringing. Absolutely. Yeah.
No, so, what about for you? When did you? I mean, did you caddy for your dad or anything?
No,
I mean,
never for my dad. Which that would be a long day. That's a lot of golf shots.
I caddied for my mom. I will say that. I missed that a little bit. I did caddy for my mom in a couple of club championships and stuff. And that's probably an easier go than caddying for a father, I'm going to say.
Yeah, no, he's just too bad. Plus, part of the game is like you want to get the caddy. As the caddy, you want to get the player in the right mindset. Like, I don't know what to say after three flub chips where you hit it twice, right? Like, yeah. You got nothing. Like, after the first
you
one, like,
distract him with some story of something you did that you weren't supposed to do as a kid. And, and he focuses on that.
After the first one, you're like, well, at least you can't do that again. But turns out, I think one of my first ones was just caddying for a buddy in a match play event, one of the city championships. He won on the 13th hole, which is the furthest point from the golf course. I had to walk all the way back.
Whoops.
Yeah. So clearly I was a good caddy though, you know, 13 apparently. Holes and you're already done.
Does that make you a good caddy or a bad caddy? So a good caddy would make sure you're getting close to the clubhouse.
Less stress. Let's get it done. Good caddies want to be done work as soon as possible, right? They don't want to keep working. Not everyone's built to work for Sungjae Im, right? So, and then, you know, it just kind of happened. Mackenzie Tour events, you know, random calls here and there. And then, you know, obviously the Canadian Open story, which told many times and don't need to get back into. So I love it. It's hard. I can tell you I'm not built to do it full time. It's hard work, it's a lot of work. Yeah, and it's like you are sore. I remember, you know, one of the last times like did it and like the guy Kaifor messed like, "Hey, you want to go for dinner?" It's like, "No, I'm not getting out of bed. Like I'm toast." See you tomorrow. What time again? All right. So it's tough. So but it's, you know,
what was the appeal? I mean, for you. I mean, whether amateur level, pro level, I mean, there's probably a different appeal for each of those, but is there something that was integral to what you were doing and, you know, that made it something of interest to you?
I think for me, it's the being able to feel like you're competing at the highest level, even though you're not personally doing it, right?
So you're partly responsible.
Yeah, but even as the amateur, right? Like in the amateur events, like I couldn't play at that level even because they're that much better. So even that's fun. So it's just fun. It's also, you get to watch golf. You get to be outside for 4 hours and get paid for it. And sometimes some days are harder than others. And hey, it's all part of the gig. And if you know, you'll hear a lot about that with Scott Martin, just like, you know, there's tough years for these guys. Like it's not an easy gig and I don't want to get too far in it, but he talked about, you know, the amount of debt he went into trying to chase it. You don't hear about caddies trying to chase it. You hear about players trying to chase it. You don't really hear about caddies trying to chase it. It's difficult. Not everybody gets to be Michael Greller, right? And pick up Jordan Spieth's bag, you know, fresh off out of college and go on to win three majors in 3 years, right?
Not
you don't
one
get
bit.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I can remember standing next to the locker room one time at an event and, you know, a guy came up and started talking to a regular caddy. I think it was Jody Yurt-Shadoff's caddy. And he said, "Oh, it must be nice to be out there and making all this money and doing your thing or whatever." And then, you know, for some reason, it just set him off. And he just started going at the guy and saying, "Hey, man, I'm out here. I got to pay for my expenses out here, but I still got a mortgage at home. And, you know, I'm trying to play the lottery every week." And that's what he said to him. "I'm trying to play the lottery every week. I'm putting in, you know, my time and my effort and my expenses. It's like buying a lottery ticket and I'm hoping it's going to pay off. And most weeks it doesn't." So it's, you know, it's certainly different when you go like we did, you know, or have, where you go and you're just doing it on a part-time basis or a one-time basis or, you know, versus, you know, making a career. I mean, that's a total different commitment. And, you know, watching the, you know, the struggles and the journey of guys like, you know, Dez and Peppers and Nate, and watching them go through and do this and be dedicated to it, you know, I think it's underrated by people. And I think people will hear that when they hear Scotty's story and what he talks about and what it takes to make it a career and make it a living.
Yeah, so why don't we hit that interview? Scott tells a lot of great stories in that interview, which we'll get to. We're going to hit that interview, and then after we get back from that interview, we're going to tell some stories, and we're going to hear from some – we had some call-ins with some stories this week, so I'm looking forward to that. So without further ado, let's get to our feature interview this week with longtime PGA Tour caddy and Canadian Scott Martin. All right, folks, we would like to welcome to the podcast Scott Martin. Scott's a longtime caddy, recently retired Canadian, and former PGA Tour looper that picked up a win as well. Just a great guy, and we can't wait to have him on the podcast and tell his stories. And the most important reason why we're so excited to have him on, he no longer is a caddy, so you know you're going to get all the stories now because there's no repercussions for telling them. So, Scott Martin, welcome to the Tee Talk podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be here talking to you guys.
We appreciate it, Scott. So let's talk about the career just really quickly. How did you get into caddying in the first place? It was a long career. So let's go right back to the beginning and just your story of how you even ended up looping for a living?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I caddied at a nice private club not far from where I live, just outside of Montreal, private golf course. And some friends of mine were going there in the summer during summer break. So I did that for 4 or 5 summers. And then I started working right out of high school. I was a welder for a long time. And following my welding career, I traveled around Asia for a couple of years, came back from Asia, and I did a presentation at a school and of my travels. And after the presentation, I was offered a job to work at the school. And I worked there for 7 years. And during my career there, I was making very little money. And I went back to club caddying. Now I'm in my early 30s. Club caddied for 3 or 4 summers there. Canadian Tour came to Montreal in 1996. Picked up a bag, a guy named Bruce Huchen, from Ottawa.
Yep.
He was a former PGA Tour caddy. Okay. And I was still a childcare worker at the time. And that happened to be in 1996, the last week of my summer break. And I was going back to school the next week to work at the school. I worked at a primary school that had between kindergarten to 6th grade, there was a disabled boy and a disabled girl in each class. And I was the attendant for the male, and I had a coworker that took care of the girls. And that was my job in the school. So, but then I did this gig for Bruce in 1996. And at the end of the week, Bruce, he gave me $50 a day. Didn't want me to work a practice round because he didn't want to have to pay me $50. Brennan Little might've played that week. Mike Weir's former caddy, works for Gary Woodland now. He was there that week. But so Bruce said to me at the end of the week, he says, you know, you could be a tour caddy. And I was like, what are you talking about? And we had a little chat about it. And so we planted a seed. Fast forward, January 97, Nike Tour was going to be starting their season in Lakeland, Florida. I took a week off of work. I went down there, didn't know anybody. I was approached by somebody in the parking lot, a player, a guy named Bill Britton, former PGA Tour winner, 1986 in Tallahassee, as it turns out, 54-hole event, and got rained out Sunday. So, he would rather have played Sunday than one. We'll put it that way. So I ended up working for Bill for the week, and we hit it off really good. And within about a year after that, I quit my job, sold my house, left my girlfriend, and went down to the States and chased the Nike Tour. And picked up a few bags here or there. Ended up working for Bill two or three years later. He brought me to the PGA Tour for a week at the BC Open in Endicott, New York. For 1 week, he said, in 1990, that was like 98 or something. And I stayed out there for 23 years.
So what was the appeal for you? I mean, obviously working for Hook, I mean, interesting guy, but, you know, and it showed you what it was sort of about, but why was it so attractive to you that made you go to Florida and you know,
Once I got back into club caddying, here I am in my early 30s, and I was like, really, I just didn't do it to like walk around and make, you know, in a days when you're like a teenager, just like to hand, you know, get your 20 or 30 bucks at the end of 18 holes. I was actually really into it. And I made a little yardage book of the club that I worked at, just no laser or anything. You know, I walked stuff off and, you know, trees and bunkers and whatnot. And a couple of members saw me doing it, you know, and they thought it was really cool that I was that into the caddying, the thing. And I'd watch the caddies on TV, you know, and I was paying attention to what they were doing. And it's funny because I heard a caddy say something once, and in one of my very first events on the Nike Tour, a player was like thinking out loud. He said, man, what did we have here yesterday? And I had taken notes of what we had to the front with the pin and how far he hit the 7-iron. He's like, man, you have that? And like, and that's when I kind of realized, like, I kind of had it that I could be a caddy, you know, and do the right thing and help players out there. And yeah, that's how I got going.
And 23 years later, you know, you went from $50 a day. I want to go back to that $50 a day. I caddied a Mackenzie Tour event, my first ever time doing a loop, and I got $40 a day. And this was like, this would have been 20 years after you caddied.
Bruce was a former tour caddy, though. Bruce was a former tour caddy. Okay. He knew the routine.
Fair enough. Know? I was like, where's the inflation?
But honestly, I think, I don't know. I'm thinking that was, there's usually a going rate, you know, amongst players. So I'm thinking maybe that was the going rate. Yeah. What year was that? It was actually probably after 1996 or whatever.
Absolutely. Well, like, I'm like talking 2015. Like, I was like, what's this guy doing?
Yeah, I think by,
I don't know. I your guy was really cheap. Your
I think by 2000, the tour said it was, you know, Canadian tour was mandatory $25 a day or whatever. Oh, but I mean, that was nothing really. I mean, that's more for local guys more than anything.
Yeah, it's funny. Bruce taught me a couple of things out there. Like, he taught me that a bag that's lying down will never fall over, because bags accidentally fall over. Some of you think, I'll just leave it there, stand up, you walk away, boom, it goes down. Everybody, you know.
Stefan knows about that very well.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, Scott. Listen to this. So last time, maybe the reason why it was last time I looped, we were at the Greenbrier in 2019, and was in the group with Chapel, and Chapel was shooting 59, and we had started on the back nine, and he's on this birdie tear, and I'm trying to get a yardage.
You were caddying in this event at the Greenbrier?
Yeah, I'm not actually his caddy, but I'm looping the same group that he shot 59.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, very cool. Great. So he's I think he's got three birdies in the row, and we're off to a tough start. We had a great first day, tough second day, and it's early in the round, and we realize, like, maybe my guy doesn't have it today, and I'm trying to get a number, trying to find where we have to actually drop this ball, because we're in this hazard, and Kev at some point said he was going to hit, and I didn't hear. And as he's addressing his golf ball, the bag fell over on the flattest part ever. Like, you've been to the Greenbrier.
Well, of course.
Soon. Flattest course you're going to caddy of all time, right? There's not a hill there, yet you're in Virginia. And somehow the bag fell over right before, and the eyes I got from him. But the nicest guy, just like, are you good? Like, he was like, are you good to me? I was like, I'm so sorry. But like, at that point, like, I'm dead. Luckily, it didn't affect him. He went on and shot 59. But it's a great piece of advice.
Wow, that's impressive. Wow, that's, yeah. A bag that's lying down will never fall over. And another thing he taught me is when you're in the bunker and you're raking your guy's footsteps and where he hit the shot, always rake over where the ball landed in the sand and then bounced. Because there's always that fried egg looking thing, right? And yeah.
I love
to rake
it.
That. Yeah. So he's gone now, right? I don't know. Bruce passed away. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's passed away now. Yeah.
Yeah, Ross. I was in touch with Ross for a long time, his brother.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know anything about his family, or I knew, like, Bruce lived a pretty edgy, he had a pretty edgy existence for a while, you know.
Yeah.
And but he was good. I liked him.
So
I even saw him after. Once I got into caddying for a few years, I would see him at the Canadian Open or something once in a while here or there. And it was always nice to see him around once, you know, occasionally. He was instrumental in me becoming a caddy for sure.
You know, yeah, all the caddies, you know, they stick together, that's for sure.
That was really nice.
Who have you caddied for over the years? Let's drop some names and maybe get into some stories of players and you know, guys that were great.
I'm
going to
say, well, I caddied for Glenn Natchuk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Canadian player from Selkirk, Manitoba.
Yep.
He was a nice player too. If he putted better, the guy was, like, if I'm not mistaken, for kind of relatively early in my career, big Flyers fan, just like I am too, our blood is orange, beautiful. he was like top 10 in driving accuracy and greens in regulation. Very good ball striker. Didn't hit it really far enough, mind you. But if he was, you know, pretty good putter, he would have had a much different career for sure.
So looking back over the years, like, who are some of the best bags to golf, to caddy for? And maybe let's go the opposite. You're not going back out. Who are some of the guys like, oh, that didn't work out? Maybe you don't have to mention names, but more the why if you have to.
Well, I'm not even sure if I want to say his name just yet, because I'm still really good friends with him and he still plays. So, but he was
Say the name.
Yeah, I'm not going to say the name. I don't want to hurt his feelings. I mean, great guy. I love him. Seriously. I mean, I'm just thinking of guys that were tough to work for, you know, like, I mean, Tom Pernice was always a really difficult man to work for, although I never worked for Tom. And, I, you know, had a rough go with Briony Baird, although there's another guy I get along with good now too. You know, we're both older. I mean, I started older. I was mid 30s when I got into caddying, and so I think he's older now and married and kids and stuff. And we just get along better. And he was tough. interesting story there. I worked for him the week after I worked for Bill Britton at the BC Open. I drove down to San Antonio, me and another guy, 36 hours, the pickup truck with a shell in the back. We didn't stop. One guy sleeping in the back, one guy in the front. Get down there. Within 10 minutes, I had a job. I get Briony Baird. Somebody sees me. Hey, you want to, I got a bag. You want Briony Baird? Sure. So I work for Briony Baird. And then I got a friend of mine from my here in Montreal to work for him for a few weeks, and which turned into a career with the, with Briony. And then I ended up working for him again, but I always thought he loved the other guy so much that he was, he wanted me to be that guy and I wasn't. So he was tough on me, you know, but we worked well together. We almost won once in, at the John Deere, but he was tough to work for. He was,
maybe our listeners don't really fully appreciate it, but yeah. And again, you don't have to really say the names. What, when you say being somebody that's tough to work for, makes it tough for the caddy in your perspective that makes it hard to work for a guy, and what makes it extra challenging?
They, a lot of, you know, I don't want to say a lot of guys, but there's guys that'll take their frustrations out in the caddy. And, you know, sometimes you're going into a job, you know, that you're, that's what you're going to be getting, you know. Some guys just need somebody to vent on, you know. Some guys handle it really good, and they can move on, or even if they carry it for a hole or two, they're bearable, you know. But some guys are just, they're just vicious, you know.
I mean you know that, you know that a little bit going in sometimes, but you know, how do you sort of you know, put that aside and just say, all right, I'll do my job. And at what point does that become unbearable for you that you go, oh, time to move on to somebody else?
We all have different tolerance, you know, levels of tolerance, you know. Some guys will take more and some guys won't take any, you know.
And you're
you just got to stand up for yourself once in a while, you know.
I think the standing up for yourself is the important part, right? Eventually, right? Yeah. Like, I think, yeah, you know, especially you came out late, right? And you're like, yeah, I don't necessarily need to be here. I want to be here. Like, you did have a career going in, and it was, you know, I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But some guys, you know, you get out there young, right? In the mm-hmm. flash and the dash of the PGA Tour. But it's not actually, you slowly learn it's really not that flashy for a lot of people. And you talk about that drive from, you know, 36 hour drive. Let's talk about that. What are some of the worst places you stayed in over the years? Cause you got in early where the money necessarily wasn't what it is now. So what are some tough situations you stayed in over the years?
Flint, Michigan was tough.
Oh, wow.
Stayed at a Super 8 there once. I mean, you didn't know, like, when cars were pulling into the lot, you were closing your door, you know. That was like some gang activity and a lot of dope and prostitutes, and it was dangerous, you know. It was just some places there was gunfire sometimes. I don't want to say like it was rampant gunfire throughout my career, but there was a few places you had to be careful. I mean, the first time I went to New Orleans, I was pretty scared, you know. I hardly went out, and I didn't stay in the best neighborhood, as it turns out. But you don't know that though, right?
Like, it's not like it is nowadays where, like, I went to Virginia. I have no idea where I am, but I can research where, like, a small town that's nice versus Flint, Michigan.
the research, I mean, hey, listen, other caddies stayed there, and other caddies that had been caddies for years stayed there. You know, like, people went back there. It's not like some guys went there and only once stayed there 1 year. Some guys would go back every year and stay there, you know? But things are different now. There's a lot of money floating around, and, you know, guys are staying in nice places. I mean, I remember staying like Suburban Lodge, you know, those places were a dive. I mean, but it was okay.
What do you think's the cheapest room you ever had over the years? What's the lowest amount of money you ever paid?
It's got to be zero.
I mean, that you actually paid for, not that someone gifted to you or something.
I mean, there was never, you know, I mean, I'm not going to spend $100 to stay for a week somewhere. I mean, I'm not going to go that low, you know, $150-$200 maybe.
Okay.
You know, nothing, there was nothing any like really out there, but, you know, sometimes it was sketchy, but when you made a little bit of money, you could up the ante a little bit and stay at the, you know, stay at the Hampton or something for a week and treat yourself, you know, which was always nice. But, you know, I mean, times have changed, right? There's like, there's guys are making good money and nobody's staying at crappy places anymore. A lot of Airbnb going on now. That's a really big thing. Even myself, the last few years caddying, that's what we did a lot in some places, you know, get three or four guys together and cook meals and, you know, stay in the house for the week. It was, you know, that's a really popular way to go now too, for sure.
Yeah, it's nice to have the friendship as well, you know, somebody yeah. else to vent with at yeah. the end of the day of, you know, because the work can be difficult.
But sometimes it's good to have your buddy around if you're going through a little bit of a stretch. But then again, there's other times where, you know, you've had a couple, two or three good weeks in a row and you want to stay by yourself for a week or two, you know. That's always nice. And it's a little bit of both. I'd say more staying with other caddies than staying alone. I'm not going to say it, and it's always because it's saving money. It's just the camaraderie and, you know, watch the whatever hockey playoffs or baseball and talk about your day and stuff. It was a lot of fun. It was great.
For sure.
Some great guys over the years, for sure.
And you mentioned, you know, the money, you know, it's really good now, but you know, you had a lot of tough years out there where, you've told the stories of like racking up extremely high credit card bills, trying to make
taxes,
a dream.
Taxes and credit card.
Exactly. Like, and you're trying to, you're chasing a dream, and people don't view the dream of chasing the dream as a caddy, but you really chase the dream of a caddy, you know, a lot of, hey, we'll work it out for the week. What is it like knowing that, hey, this week is like, this could be make or break. Cause my credit card is right at the max point. Talk about your mindset there.
I'll tell you what's tough when you got a guy and you're going into the week, all you want is to make the cut. I'll take it from there. I'll start with the extra $400 or $500 for the week, and maybe it'll get better than that. It was huge. I have this like sick feeling in my stomach right now just thinking about it. It's terrible. You know, I mean, it's not the end of the world. There's a lot of people that go through a lot more things than that. Instead of worrying about some guy, worrying if he's a caddy, if he's going to make the cut on the PGA Tour, like poor you, you know. That's really tough. You go. I had a couple of really crappy years. I there was one season I went, didn't make one cut all year.
Wow.
Working for different guys. You know,
how many times did you want to just call it?
Not very often.
Why do you think that is though? Because you go that many, a full year.
What am I going to do? Go home and make $18 an hour as a welder and like finish on Friday at 5 and maybe work and get time and a half on Saturday for a few hours. And you really don't want to go because you don't like the job to begin with. Never mind having to do overtime. Right. Or are you going to go on the PGA Tour if you're lucky enough to get out there in any capacity, whether you're working for the best player in the world or whether you did what I had to do for some years with scratch and claw to survive. I'd rather scratch and claw to survive and have a chance at that excitement and to see that level of golf from up close. And maybe on a Sunday, you're going to have some guy who's not the greatest player on tour, but is going to have a really good week. And a caddy, you're going to make like $20,000 or $30,000 US. That's never going to happen when you're a welder making $18 an hour.
Yeah. There's not a lottery when you're welding.
The only lottery when you're welding is the lottery. If you win, that's the only lottery in welding.
Well, let's talk about.
It's just very like the Masters is next week. You know, I got the caddy net a couple of times, and there was times before I got into the Masters that were difficult years. You know. And I hung on, and like what happened? I ended up caddying in the Masters a couple of times. You know, I ended up winning after having tough years. Didn't win till like 14 years into my career.
14 years, you know? and you finally pick up that win in Puerto Rico. Like,
I have a buddy of mine, Damien Lopez, works for Michael Thompson. They won like maybe a month ago. It's first time in 20 years the guys won a golf tournament. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So what was that like though when you picked up that win in Puerto Rico?
That was great.
As we talked about all that money that, you know, the debt.
Oh, crazy. you know, you're talking about like the dream. We know when you're a dream, like you want to sit as a caddy or whatever. Like my dream was to like have a guy that was good enough to make a check that I can get a debt. That was my dream. It wasn't like, you know, having this big, long, illustrious career. So just get me out of the hole. We'll take it from there. You know, it was so worth it. Come on. It was so worth it.
And you got it done that week, right? And like,
what's that?
Did you got it done that week? And did it help you get back into the black, or was that like how big of a game changer was that?
I was free and clear. I was out of debt after that. I owed about 55, and I made almost $70,000. I had some left over. I blew it.
What did you blow it on? Is what I want to know.
Well, no, I didn't blow. I mean, you know, in the real world, I mean, when you're on the road a lot, it doesn't take long to go through $10,000.
No.
It doesn't last long. In the real world, you got a mortgage and groceries and maybe kids and whatnot. 10 grand doesn't go very far, you know? So.
Where did you maintain your home base during the whole time? Was it always Montreal, or did you have a home base?
There was the time that I didn't really cross the border a whole lot, you know, but I ended up getting married, and which was a real marriage, you know, and I was married for a few years, and I lived in Southern California, and through marriage, I got a green card, and then I ended up becoming a citizen as well.
Okay.
So,
Did you always dream, though, of coming back to Montreal at some point?
Not really. No, I mean, because I loved it. I lived in Southern California, and I lived in Austin, Texas, or just south of Austin in San Marcos. Two great places, and I was, like, totally content, and I would have been content just coming home and seeing family and friends once in a while and seeing Montreal and going up to Mount Royal and having poutine and smoked meat or whatever, you know. But I love living in the States. But I did come home because my father was getting older and my sister was doing a lot to take care of him. And I thought, you know, good thing to come home and try to do my share. And I was home for a couple of years. He ended up passing away a couple of years ago. So I've been back for 5 years now, and I'm incredibly happy being home again. Montreal is home is where the heart is. It's just the way it is. I've been lucky enough to travel a lot and see a lot of great cities. And Montreal is a really good city, and it happens to be my home too. So I'm really happy here again. Very happy. Yeah.
That's awesome. And you know, you obviously wrapped it up. You don't did a few years on the Champions Tour as well. And before wrapping it up, and you know, nice to know every week I'm getting a paycheck, I assume.
Yeah, for sure. We're making a cut. But I mean, making the cut and finish last in the Champions Tour is like, well, I just worked 2 days for $75. I mean, you know, hopefully your guy is decent enough. But I had a decent player out there, and he did win, actually. And he had a chance to win every week, although he didn't show that he could win every week. Steve Flesch was a really good player, you know, great swing and touch and short game and putter and all the length and all that stuff, you know. Crazy mofo, but he's the first one to admit it, you know, but he's his own worst enemy out there for sure. But a great person, though. Great guy.
Yeah. And there's a lot of crazy guys out there. And one that I know, your best buddy, Vijay Singh. You guys are, it's safe to say, best friends. Why don't you tell us the story of when you were just finally tired with his...
Well, you know, I ended up retiring. I got to say, there was one thing that happened many years ago, and I've been paired with the guy a lot, and I've seen the way he can treat caddies, and I heard stories about, you know, firing a guy like at Thanksgiving in the U.S. because a guy wouldn't go out and practice with him that day. Well, I got family with me here, and like we're here for Thanksgiving, and well, it's me or the family, and the guy stayed home and lost his job. He works for Webb Simpson now, so he's doing okay. But another time we're paired with, I was working for Joel Edwards. We're paired with Vijay and Fred Funk. And Fred Funk's caddy Fred Funk had a guy in the bag. His name is Mark Long. He makes fantastic yardage books now. Very intelligent guy. Is a lawyer. The guy's a lawyer. And Vijay said something in Michigan at Flint about caddies being stupid. We're standing on a tee waiting to tee off on a par five or something. The guys weren't far enough, and there was a conversation. He said something about stupid caddies or they're dumb or something like that, and Mark just looked at me like, Mark is a really intelligent guy and well-spoken, a really nice person, you know. And So that was that, you know, Vijay did crap like that over the years. So in 2019 in Calgary, we were, you know, it's nice to be in Calgary, big gallery in the first hole. I used to live in Calgary too. I love going to that tournament. It was, it's one of the better tournaments on that tour for sure. Stephen Ames had a lot to do with getting that tournament there, but, I'm working for Brett Quigley at the, in Calgary. We get up onto the first tee for the first round, and Vijay's there, and I put the bag down. Brett's name is on the bag, and Vijay looks at the name on the bag, and he looks at me, and yes, I have worked for a number of different players over the course of my career here and there. Hey, listen, I gotta say this as well. I have worked for some really good players. Peter Launder was a top 50 player in the world. Joel Edwards is a really good player. I worked for Nota Begay. I've had some nice bags, you know, had chances to win numerous times. It's not like it was all, you know, scratch and clawing the whole way. So I just want to say that it was a pretty decent career all in all. It was a fantastic career all in all. So he looks at me and looks at the name of the bag and he goes, man, you get around. Exact words. I said, you know, and I was like, I'm proud of myself. Okay. I say, this is my 11th bag of the year. Cause guys were at, it was getting to like 8, 9, 10 guys. Who do you got this week? Who do you got this week? It was almost like, we want you to have different players every week to see how many you can get. So, he says, you get around. And I said, this is my 11th guy, 11th bag of the year. He says, maybe you're a shitty caddy.
Wow.
And like, I almost have that feeling inside me right now. It really pissed me off. But I said to him, it took a few seconds, and I said, you know, I've been out here 23 years, and I do. I have a nice – I don't live in the house, but I own a nice home. I have a nice home that I got through caddying because I was a caddy. Great family, friends, great stories, a couple of wins, you know. I'm giving him that story. I said, I've had a really good career, and I'm really happy. And then he says, well, 23 years is probably time for you to retire. So regardless of what I said, he was like digging at me, you know. And I was just thinking of Mark Long, and I was thinking other guys I've seen him shit on, you know, and he was really pissing me off. He was really, really irritating me. So we ended up teeing off, and then we get to the 16th hole, and he's my guy. Brett's on the green. It's part three. He's on the green at two. He's like 2 or 3 feet below the hole, and Vijay's hit his tee shot about 15 feet above the hole. He's a good putt for birdie, and we were playing with Brandel Chambly. He was like in there 6 feet or something like that. And so Vijay's away. Now we're in the day of the pin staying in, right? But it's fairly new, the pin staying in the cup if the guys want to putt with it in. So I don't know everybody's routine on the tour. And it's common courtesy what caddies will do. And you're going to know what I'm talking about. Like some guy's 30 feet away and I might be near the pin and my guy's 2 feet and I will like offer to take the pin out. Right. Do you want it? And here he is 15 feet. I'm thinking maybe he's going to want the pin out. And I look at his caddy, Danny Sale. Do you guys know Danny Sale?
Yeah. No Diesel. Yeah.
Good guy. I mean, I love the guy. He's a great
solid
guy.
Man,
he's
yeah.
put up with a lot of
He's coached too.
A lot of What's that?
He coaches him a little
I remember
bit.
I remember one time he told me, he said, yeah, when Vijay and I played today, he said he shot 65. I really goes, hey, I shot 64. The guy's a really good player. So anyways, I look at Danny and I go like this, meaning, do you want the pin out? Neither of us are saying a word. And he's shaking his head. He's going like this. Okay. And then as this exchange is going on, which lasts about 5 seconds, Vijay's like, what's with this? And I said, what was that? And now you've hated me and I'm all in. And he goes, oh, you're always around the pin. I said, look, hey, it's a common courtesy. I'm just trying to help the guy out. You know, nobody's told me I'm not allowed near the pin. And now like Brett Quigley, who's 3 feet away, is settle down, guys, settle down, you know, take it easy. Cause it's heated. You can really feel it, you know, especially like for coming from me. And so Vijay putts with the pin in and he leaves it like this, 2 inches, taps it in, and he takes his ball out and he takes the pin out and he like goes to hand, I'm whatever, 10 feet away, goes, you know, here's your pin, all like sarcastic with a smart ass look on his face. And I did say, so don't be a smart ass. And now Brett's here again, right, take it easy, guys, you know, take it easy. And of course, does Brett make his 2 or 3 footer? To make it worse, if he misses, he misses. Now I'm like,
I'm way wrong, but my mindset is it's that guy's fault that this all happened. But it's me, right? It's how I handled it. I was freaking fed up with the guy, and I made a beeline towards him, and I got, I'm not going to say nose to nose, but I was close to his face, and I called him, you're a motherfucker, and who the fuck think you are, you condescending everything, blah, blah, blah. I just bombarded him. It's Danny standing there, looks like he's like this, looking at me, talking to VJ, standing behind VJ a little bit. And I just like exhausted myself ripping into the guy. And I said, you know what, VJ? I said, I'm nice out here. I'm nice to people. I'm respectful. I treat people right. I said, people like me. I said, you know what? Nobody likes you out here. And whatever, we just kind of went our own ways and saw each other a few times over the course of the next few weeks. But it was like really crappy. You know, I mean, I didn't give a rat's ass personally, you know. One time I drove by, I was working for Scott for Plank. We drove by in a cart, and there's VJ in a cart, little practice day, a little like it's drizzling out. So he's sitting in his cart under a tree, you know, him and Danny. And our cart drives by. And as we drive by, VJ looks at our cart and he goes, like, he's giving me the finger guaranteed, you know. And Scott for Plank, he just looks over and like gives them like a fun finger, like they're playing, you know. And as we ride by, I said to him, Scott, I said, I don't think that was for you.
And it probably, did you know at that point, because based on my calculation, that was your last year on tour. Did you know at that point that this is it? Might not get a chance to do this?
No. I still thought I was going to continue. I was just going to grind it out and see who I could get as time went on. And Brett had said that if he got out there on a regular basis, he wanted me to caddy for him, because I used to work for Brett Quigley. And so that was kind of like my hope for the following season. Here we are, September 9th. I'm thinking, you know, February of 2020, maybe if Brett plays good enough, he can get full status, I can work for him. But as it turns out, that didn't happen. And I ended up being offered a job by Scott for Plank. And I decided to go out for 4 weeks to start the year. And it was during the course of that 4 weeks that I decided I was going to go home. I was just not into it. I knew I was like, the flame was totally out. I was going through the motions, not enjoying every day out there. And I knew it was over. But we had I told Scott in our second week that what was going on. And I'd also reached out to people in the film industry, which I'm where I'm working right now. And they gave me I had a really good opportunity to do that if I wanted to. And it was during that 4 week stretch with Scott that I decided not to, but I stayed with him. We went to Morocco and stuff, which was cool. And like a one tournament in Florida and Newport Beach, California and Tucson, Arizona. I told him in Tucson our second week, and I was really nervous about telling him, but we met in the parking lot and we were going to ride over in a cart, because Scott could ride a cart all the time if you wanted, being a diabetic. And we rode over in the cart and I said, hey, can we stop here for a second? I want to tell you something. I'm a little apprehensive wanting to tell him. And I told him what was going on. He goes, man, I'm really going to miss you, but I understand. I get it. You know, I hope you have a great career. And it felt really good. So my next like 3 weeks with them were very nice. And I left my shoes. You guys probably didn't see it first, you know, because I'm on my Facebook thing. On my very last day at Newport Beach, I finished the round. I had hidden a dry pair of shoes under the grandstands before the round on Sunday. And after the round on Sunday, I took my shoes and I put them on the edge of the 18th green. I got this really cool picture with the flag and the 18th hole in the background. And I left my shoes there and I told the volunteer, I said, when I'm gone, you can throw those in the garbage. You do it. I told them what I was doing, you know, and I left my shoes on the 18th green and walked away. And it was, it was great. It was funny. Coronavirus happened after that week. So then a couple of weeks later, Verplank calls me. He goes, hey, look, did you know that when you retired that the whole golf world would stop?
It's all your...
It was kind of funny, but
yeah, it's all my your
last
fault.
Week was when... I'm sorry?
It's all your fault. You brought... You just knew. You're Nostradamus out there. Knew to get out.
Yeah. I feel like I was kind of rambling there, but that was my... That was kind of like
no,
my,
that, that,
end of the run story, you know?
I think everyone has that moment they think about in retirement, right? Like, when I get there, this is the last day. You know, some people are like, I'm going to... my boss's desk, right? Like, and I think you went out in the other way. But what about, like, let's just talk about that last loop. You knew it was your last one. It sounds like everything I've heard from you, you have zero interest in ever going back out. Money talks. Who knows? But like, what was that last loop like for you, knowing, hey, this is it?
Well, you know, As much as I wasn't into it the first, especially the first week when I went out and I realized I didn't want to do it anymore when we were in Newport Beach, I loved it out there and I stay with some friends out there and I really enjoy it, but I just wasn't, I knew it was over. But once I told Scott what was going on, I knew I was done. I got into caddying and I really gave it my all. I had a good talk with my girlfriend and she reinforced in me, hey, make sure you like go out in a flurry, you know, work hard and be positive and do the best job you can do, you know? So, that's what I did. I did. I worked hard and I was into it and I was enjoying it. And I was like, wanted him to do good. And, yeah, that's how I felt the last couple of weeks in the last round. And I wish I remember who we played with, but I've had some nice pairings there. I have worked for Jesper before, but we played with Jesper there one time. And, Fred Couples played with Fred there. Fred Couples.
That's pretty solid. I mean, for you, though, are you a golf guy? I mean, that's one thing we haven't really talked about. I mean, yeah, you're a caddy, well, but are you a golfer?
Yeah, I play golf, but I'm a chop, you know. I've had some decent rounds. You know, I've shot a handful of rounds in the mid-70s, which is pretty decent golf. And I can shoot like 80 to 84 around there, but I can shoot 93. You know, I'm not like a stick by any means. You know, I play golf. I'm not a player.
Are you going to hang around the golf course more now?
I don't really, even like my place, I have very little things about golf. Okay. My intention this summer, I didn't want to play golf. Plus, I mean, the pandemic was going on. So I guess in the first early parts of the year, there was no golf. And then I think like in August, a buddy of mine convinced me to go play 9 holes. For $20 after 6 p.m. And you know where we played? Where I caddy for Bruce Hewkin.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. You know what? Well, we'll go play at Dorval. It's called Dorval.
Yeah.
And we'll go play there. And it didn't really dawn on me until I pulled it. I was actually riding I don't have a car. I was riding a motorcycle with my golf bag over my shoulder. Awesome. And I was pulling it together. I said, this is ironic, man. I caddy for Bruce Hewkin here. I thought it was just kind of weird. And I ended up playing probably half a dozen times golf this summer, and I really enjoyed it. And I ended up playing last round I played at Royal Montreal, and I doubled the first hole. I shot 38 in the front nine.
That's pretty solid.
That's pretty decent golf. I was over my head. I was getting uncomfortable. you know, when you play golf, you're playing a little too late. You're playing a little better than you are. Well, that doesn't last. I mean, it's going to catch up to you that day, not the next round. It's going to catch up.
Oh, absolutely.
Or it does me anyways.
It did for me literally the other day. I was beating Scott through like 17 holes, and I didn't want to get to 18. So we drove off to the cart because I just didn't want to have to go through that last hole. You said you don't have many mementos hanging around, though. Like, what do you have anything from your days? Do you have the flag still from Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I got the flag. Like right now, I'm sitting in my bedroom, and I over there in the corner, I have a flag I got from George McNeil that when we won in Puerto Rico. So, I mean, your first flag in the PGA Tour, you got to frame it and hang it up. I mean, come on. And I do have that up, and I have like a driver head that Steve Flesh broke at the Senior British Open, snapped off the shaft. I got it there, and he autographed it for me. And I have the Steve Flesh flag from the Champions Tour win, but that's rolled up like on top of a bag over there. So I've got like the driver head and my flag and a Jason Bone $5 autographed $5 bill.
Steve went through a lot of equipment over the years, so I'm not surprised he got a head out of that. So.
Steve, I remember one time. God, can I tell this story?
Yes.
I can remember him at Valspar one year, and I was talking to him down at the equipment trailer, and he couldn't find a driver because he said all the drivers would spin too much. And he literally, I think he was testing like 8 drivers that day. I didn't know him, and he bent my ear for probably 45 minutes. And I was thinking,
you were willing to listen.
Yeah, why not?
And for you, it was fun to listen to a PGA Tour player like spill his guts about a driver with too much spin. I mean, I remember one time he has a set of irons. He's going to dump a set of irons, literally. And I said, well, don't you have any, like, what about, like, where are you going to get more? And he looked at me like totally dead serious, no smile. And he goes, inventory is not a problem. Like He has like a warehouse at his house.
Yeah.
He can be up at 2 o'clock in the morning to have a leak, and he's gonna be the mad scientist out in the garage with the light over his head grinding something and totally Steve Flesh.
Yeah, totally. I think Griffin got that from him as well. His son got that from him too.
Griff is, oh god, I got a great picture of them. We're in Minnesota a couple of years ago, and they're at the equipment trailer, and they're standing there side by side, and they're both pulling a shaft. The shaft bag is got like 200 shafts in it, right? They're both pulling one out at the same time, and it looks like a mirror. The two of them on the same angle with the shafts, the father son standing side by side. Yeah, he's crazy too.
How much harder is it to caddy for a guy that equipment focused, right? Like where they're so dialed into every small detail versus, you know, a guy that's just like, hey, give me the clubs and let's just make this work. Is there a difference for you?
Yeah. Like, is it difficult to caddy for a guy like that compared to a guy that doesn't do that?
Exactly. What do you think is the biggest difference between the two?
Well, I mean, it gets to a point where it's just like the guy's talking about a club with too much spin or loft or whatever. He's going to change again. Like, yeah, okay. You don't even fight it, you know? You don't even fight it. And it's not like I'm no freaking swing guru and equipment guru and some guy's talking about shaft. I mean, I get it. I mean, I was around the game long enough. I understand that, you know, but when it gets to guys that take it to an extreme, you know, you just like.
Nod your head and keep going.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, you know, you're talking about obviously the VJ story and talking about, you know, players giving respect to caddies. You know, has there been situations out there where you get, you know, players that maybe, you know, think they can maybe just go on their own and you guys are not valuable in any possible way?
Yeah. Who'd you mention before?
Kevin Chappell. Just saying, you mentioned VJ and there was more respect for players, but just any players in general that just, you know, they don't think caddies are valued.
Yeah, I think there's players out there that do think that. And these guys are so good, you know. I mean, I think like when Tiger started earlier in his career, he'd have his buddy Jerry Chang come and caddy for him. Remember Jerry Chang?
Oh, yeah.
Tiger would have won with anybody on the bag. And these guys, when they're playing well, they don't really need a lot of help. Some guys, it happens once in a while, they need some help in a crucial time. But when they're dialed in and playing good, they don't need a lot of help. Talked about Kevin Chappell shooting 59. I don't know. Maybe, like I said, some guys, when they play really well, their caddies are instrumental in a day like that. But for the most part, I don't think so. Stuart Sink said something jokingly about his caddy, how he really didn't need him that much that day when he shot 59 at the Greenbrier. And I was once walking the golf course by myself at the Memorial in Ohio. Fantastic tournament. Love that place. Have you guys been there?
I have not.
That surprises me, actually. Mm-hmm. But walking the golf course there, you know, get there a day early and walk 9 holes on late Monday afternoon and 9 holes early Tuesday morning. That was usually my routine, then play a Tuesday morning practice round. But I'd be at the course crack of dawn on Tuesday morning to get those 9 holes in, you know, especially earlier in my career. But so I'm walking the golf course and I come across a couple of good young players. Not right now good young players, but good young players back then, which isn't too long ago. I'm going to say one guy won the FedEx Cup. I'll give you that. One guy won the FedEx Cup.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good player, right? And another good player.
Probably got lucky.
Screw it. Billy Horschel and Matt Every. Okay? All good players.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good players. And I was like, whatever. I would talk like this once in a, you know, sometimes I wanted to understand why things happen, try to get an understanding of why things happen. Maybe like hoping like to make me a better caddy or to understand the situation better, you know? And I said to the two of them, and they weren't walking with their caddies. They were walking the two of them and myself. I think the caddies that hole, maybe the fourth hole, you four caddy, the caddies were up ahead and I was back at the tee checking the yardage book and met them and walked down. I asked them and I said, okay, how instrumental, the two of you, was your caddy in your victory? And the both of them said, I could have won without him.
Wow. How does that make you feel? I mean, when you heard that, just disrespect.
Really good. No. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it didn't hurt my feelings that, you know, maybe caddies aren't as important. You know, yeah. So they thought they could have, you know, done fine without having their guys out there in the bag.
Hmm. Brutal. You mentioned, you know, a couple of those guys and the fact that, you know, they felt that they could win without their caddies. And a couple of those guys, they've had some interesting careers. You know, you're out of it now, so I'm sure you'll answer this. What's the biggest secret about the PGA Tour that the fans don't know?
That they never really know what's going on with players off the golf course. I don't know if that makes any sense. You know, people always say, like, hey, what's wrong with that guy? How come he's not playing stupid? What's the way? You never know what's really going on. People, fans look at the players like they should be performing week in and week out and making them happy as fans. And sometimes when players don't play well, they feel let down and are disappointed in the players. But you never really know what's going on in people's lives.
Yeah.
Aside from that, there's no big secret. Pretty much, I mean, look at social media nowadays. There's not many secrets out there anymore.
That's fair.
True.
You know, like the Tiger thing and all the cheating, the infidelity. I never heard one word uttered about it out there. Never. And you know what? I work for his best friend. I work for Nota Begay. I never heard one word about that.
It's crazy.
And look what happens. Look what got exposed. You know, but I mean, honestly, like in all my years out there, there was nothing like, there was no like big scandals or anything. The Robert Allenby thing in Hawaii was kind of interesting.
Were you there?
There's a tool. I'm not afraid to say that. Robert Allenby, definitely one of the least liked people in the world of golf.
Were you there that week?
Because he's an ass. Yeah, I was there that week.
What were the conversations on the course that week when that all happened? Like, were guys just laughing or, you know, like... What went down?
You know,
that
a
way?
Player, an agent, they can try to spin things how they want, you know.
But yeah. You all knew the truth.
Well, I mean, you know,
it is what it is.
Yeah.
Well,
black eyes, you know, drunk.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it at this.
Big mouth, yeah. Arrogant. It's not a good mix.
Fair enough.
You know,
let's leave it at this. We get the question often and we'll wrap it up after this. And we appreciate you coming on, Scott, and telling stories. But often people just ask, hey, you know, young guys or girls wanting to get into potentially caddying as a career, you know, what advice would you tell them if that's the route they want to go down and whether they should do it, but also if they how to actually get there, get to potentially the highest.
You know, we mentioned it a little bit before, like I got my start and you had some experience too, the McKenzie Tour. You know, there's some players that I'd have to think nowadays, there's some players on that tour that are not traveling with a caddy full time.
Nope.
Is that accurate?
Oh yeah. There's not enough money to do it.
So like, right. So whoever's traveling with a player nowadays, they're both flat broke probably. You know, maybe have some, I shouldn't say they're both flat broke, but they might have some backing, you know, there's sponsorship that goes on and stuff, right? So some people are in a position that they can sacrifice time out there and finances to chase a dream, you know? So yeah, if you get a chance, McKenzie Tour, if you can get to the Korn Ferry Tour, even that tour is harder nowadays, you know, because when I started going out to the Nike Tour back in the 90s, you could get a bag here or there for $400 or $500 a week. You know, there was guys out there at the time that traveled without a full-time caddy. They didn't have the budget to hire somebody full-time, you know. And that's the route to take. But, I mean, I'm going to say they're both – Canadian Tour, you go hungry, and the Korn Ferry Tour, it's a little difficult to probably get a bag nowadays because there's a lot of people that are willing to, like I said, take that chance for a season or two – with the hopes of getting on the PGA Tour. You know, it's going to happen. It happened, what is it, 25 guys a year from that tour get out on the regular tour? So, you know, it's a possibility. It's a long shot nowadays, but I think that's the best route to go if you have, like, no connections. because you can go to these tournaments and you can go to the local, there's always a caddy master there, and there might, he might keep a list of locals that are available to caddy for the week. You know, Joe Blow comes in, hey, you got any local guys that'll work for me for the week? Yeah, that's the way to go nowadays, I think. And or unless you know a guy that plays college golf and you're his teammate in college golf and he brings you out there, that happens a lot now, which I think is a good idea. They understand the game and everything and the player and stuff. I think that's a really good route. And instead of giving money to somebody they don't know, they're giving their really good pal $500,000 a year to caddy for him. You know, that's why a lot of that goes on now.
Absolutely.
Because those guys 30 years ago, there's no chance you're going to get a guy like that out in the golf course caddying, making $200 a week and traveling four guys in a car and sleeping four guys in a hotel room. You know, now they're flying around in private. You're getting out of college, you know, as a caddy and flying around in private jets with their buddy who's making really good cash and making $500,000 or $750,000 a year. You know, a lot of that goes on now.
That's no Flint, Michigan. That's for sure.
That's no Flint, Michigan there for sure. Yeah.
Well, I think you touched on two things there. One, you know, expect a few tough years before you get to the PGA Tour consistently or to any tour consistently where you're going to make a lot of money. But the thing, I'm going to wrap it all up with this. So knowing that that's the case, how much I need to know, how much money would somebody need to pay you to get you back looping again for, let's say, 1 week, just 1 week.
Oh, for a week. I mean, I just go regular rate for a week. No problem.
All right. Okay. Full season. Then how much do you need to make for a full season guaranteed?
Hey, listen, I have a really good job right now that I really like. And the money's quite good. And it's like really easy physically, mentally. Mm-hmm. I'd have to make it'd have to be at least 200,000 for the year, which in the PGA Tour nowadays is not a lot of money. You know, 200 quarter million, 250 or something like that. Nothing less than that.
All right. Well,
I don't make that now, but I'm just too happy being home and everything and waking up in Montreal every day and being really happy being here. Yeah. Wow. $250,000, maybe 300,000.
It's going up. So whoever's listening, you might want to get to Scott sooner if you're looking for a guy that with all the experience. Well, Scott, we really appreciate it. I feel like this won't be the last time we'll talk to you on the podcast.
You guys are great guys. And Scott, you are the spitting image of a good friend of mine whose name is Scott. And he lives in San Marcos, Texas. Yeah.
That's right.
So, yeah, you guys are super nice. And if you ever want to talk any other time, I'd be happy to chat about things. I'd be happy to. Nice people, and I enjoyed myself. Aside from that one time, really going off track, but it's to be expected.
Okay.
As per usual, with 30 years of caddying, kind of kill some brain cells. Thanks so much, Scott. We really appreciate it.
Nope.
Thank you, Scott Martin, for that interview. Always insightful, very open. I think my new rule is caddies that are now retired and have zero interest in going back in the game will tell a lot more stories on the record than, you know, we've heard all the stories off the record. We know who the worst guy out on tour is, pays the least, all that stuff. And we got a lot on the record here this week, which we liked with Scotty.
Yeah, great guy, obviously Canadian, amazing career. I mean, just to be out there for that long and to work for so many different people and, you know, just to be honest about it too and be real. And the fact that he's not going back out there, you're right, he can be a little bit more honest and share some of those stories. And I guess that sort of shows you too, you know, it's not all grapes and gravy out there. There's definitely some hardships and there's definitely some conflicts and all sorts of things that can go on.
Yeah, especially like when you're, you know, you finally get that win and it's in Puerto Rico, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, you're grinding it out too. It's not like a big event by any means, but awesome. You know, we've joked for years, that's the fifth major and, or was that the Bermuda Championship?
No. It's gotta be Puerto Rico. Cause Martin won that, right?
So, yeah. That's
no, he went Dominican. No, he won Puerto Rico. Yes.
There you go. Well, you put out this week though, because we said it was going to be a caddy episode, your favorites, people's favorite stories about having caddies. So why don't we tell a couple that we saw on here, and then from there, what we'll do is we'll we'll use our call-ins here.
sure.
Friends and fans of the show that called in and told some stories.
Yeah, it's it was pretty interesting. I mean, there's a lot of people have done sort of some of the things we've done. They've gone out and caddied on the, you know, on the Canadian tour, the LPGA tour. Some have done it for friends. Some have done it, you know, kind of randomly. But a lot of them were quick to get back with some stories. So we'll start with one here. Keith Dines, who works for Ping Canada, good friends with Mackenzie Hughes. And you know, they've been very close. And early on in Max's career, Keith has caddied for him multiple times, but he told the one story. He said he caddied for Mac at a web.com tour event in New York near his wife's hometown. He said, "I forgot my running shoes on day one and caddied in my Birkenstocks for six holes. It rained for 5 to 6 hours the night before until his wife, then his fiance, brought me running shoes, which were on the top of the other car. He finished tied for fifth that week. The look I got from Mac when we got the putting green was priceless." He did say that, you know, from after that, he sort of went on just a lot of success. But, you know, they always go back and talk about some of those days of him. And I mean, I can't even imagine you're out there, web.com tour, now Korn Ferry tour. And then, you know, it's your buddy, which makes it even worse. And he shows up and you're kind of looking at him, like, come on, I'm trying to be a pro here,
yeah,
or whatever.
You want
to,
like, caddies and burkies,
right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You don't want to be that guy because, yeah, you know, you're going to get labeled in the locker room for sure.
That's great. Another one here that I had a good laugh at, this one. This is from Chris Caldwell from Mizuno, Canada. So he says, from the 1993 Ontario Open at Bridgewater Golf Club. He was fired after two rounds. He showed up, he kept up, and after two rounds of poor green reading, he didn't shut up. so he said, player tee to green was awesome. After 18 on second round, he was happy he made the cut after hitting 30 of 36 greens in two rounds and was only minus four. I told him he should be leading the tourney the way he was hitting it. He was giving the hole away on too many putts. I told him I played the track many times and not to play so much break. When he showed up to get the bib for the third round, he handed him $60 and said he won't be needing him anymore. I guess this was Tony Mollica from Ohio.
Yeah, and he said Stephen Leaney was in his group too, but I mean, yeah, that's hilarious. I mean, I guess you can get over familiar sometimes early and you sort of forget that these guys are, you know, this is their job and you're no different than a million other people that have just carried their bag before. So if you kind of get ahead of yourself, they're going to let you know about it.
Yeah. Also easily replaceable.
Yeah. Very much.
The job security, on a caddy's bag is almost as good as the job security for anyone within the Trump administration right
yeah,
now.
It's not even, you're not even guaranteed 18 holes. People have to realize that. Plenty of caddies have not made it from the practice ground to the first tee or, you know, been sacked between nines for
Absolutely.
Sure. All right, I got one here, two actually. Travis Honer, who's plays in our tournament and is a listener of the podcast, he sent in a couple. Wasn't sure. I didn't realize that he'd caddied a bunch before, but yeah, he actually did some caddying at Magna, a golf club that we played before.
They're not a big deal.
Yeah, CP Women's Open Aurora. Here's his two stories. The one he said, at the club, each group would be paired with a four caddy, and one of my first loops there was a brand new member, NHL star player Steve Thomas, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Also in the group was another club member of by the name of Ty Domi. I mean, obviously we know who Ty Domi is. Ty was exactly as advertised, a little rough around the edges, a bit of a temper, and really, really funny. Highlight of the day was a middle of the 12th fairway, 360-degree leak. I'm not sure what that means, but immediately followed by a duff three-wood, a booming F-bomb, and world-class club toss that might still be airborne. Stumpy, which was Ty Domi's nickname, was an unbelievably nice...
That's Steve Thomas.
Sorry. Lost it there. Stumpy was an unbelievably nice guy, and as an old-school Leaf fan, he's still one of my favorite players. Yeah.
Great story. I've been there. You got the helicopter toss. It happens. So.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was funny because I told him back a story about playing behind Ty Domi one time where I got goaded into hitting a golf ball over Ty Domi in the group in front of us and by another Leaf player, but I won't get into that one. Maybe another time, not in the caddy story one. All right. Also at Magna, he said, I got matched with a couple of Bay Street investment guys who had a penchant for gambling while on the golf course. One of the guys was getting steamrolled by his buddy all day long. After about six lost presses in a row, he was in the hole more than $20,000. We were on the 18th hole, and Mr. Lost Press had a 10-foot putt for birdie. Make it, and he would erase the entire 20K. Miss it, and he would be in the hole way more than that. He calls me in for the read. It was a straightforward putt with it breaking just outside the edge. I was more nervous than he was as he stood over the putt, feeling that it was my head on the line if he blew it. Thankfully, he made a great roll and sent it to the bottom of the cup to saw off the match. After the round, he called me over, said thanks for the read, handed me $500. I missed that play, so that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. That's
nervy. That's nervy, though.
Yeah.
that's the other thing, though. People don't realize that, you know, while we go out there and you're caddying for a player, you know, it's great that you're part of it and that you're not hitting the shots, but you also feel that stress, especially if they're coming down near the cut line, whether they're going to make it or not. And those are things you begin to think about, and you want to help your player, and you want to make them help, you know, make them look good on TV and be successful at the tournament. So you start to feel that same type of pressure as if you were playing.
Oh yeah. No, it is nerve wracking, you know, a good day Thursday, you know, a good nine, you're feeling good. And it just goes and comes so quick. It's crazy. This one comes from Michael Collins. Brian Reed sent it in via Michael Collins, but Michael Collins, you might know, is ESPN caddy pretty much everywhere on social media, part of the caddy network as well. But he says, in 2010, Troy Merritt and caddy Brian Reed won the season-long 1 million Kodak Challenge in a playoff after the Disney tournament finished. Merritt made the cut and finished T30. That might seem insignificant, but that result at the final event of the year meant Merritt finished 125th on the money list, making him the last man to keep his full playing privileges for the 2011 PGA Tour season. That, plus the $1 million from the Kodak Challenge, gave Merritt the idea to do something extra special for Reed. Troy says to me at the car late on Sunday Eve, I've been talking to my uncle who's in money management. I want to give you $50,000 in cash and then set up two $25,000 college fund for your daughters. How could a 23-year-old pro golfer think of that? But that's just how great of a guy Troy Merritt is. I have heard that. This guy is just unbelievable to think that 23 years old, be like, hey, this guy's fresh out of college, right? Like maybe a couple years out on the tour, right? Doesn't have a lot of money in the bank, and here's $100K, you know, going that way. That's just awesome.
Yeah, and to be thoughtful as well, to think, you know, about that person's family. You know, it's not just handing them the money. He's thinking about, you know, their long-term success as well. So super thoughtful. And again, these are some of the things people forget about with the players. I mean, it's really easy for people to jump on players over, you know, certain things on social media, and they'll just kind of get on them, but they don't really know what they're like. And these are some of the cool things that people get to see inside the ropes and when they start to get to know the players.
All right, we got one more here, Scotty. Let's wrap it up with this, and then we'll get to our call-in segment.
All right. Well, I got two little. These are actually two separate ones here, but they were basically a couple of favorite stories that I kind of found online. I thought they were interesting. They were written by a guy over in Europe, so he had it in a certain way. So I'll have to phrase it properly here, so it's more in our North American manner. But on the PGA Tour, basically, this is a story about why a caddy should always do their homework. So on the US PGA Tour, a veteran tour caddy, who has worked for a lot of top players, is caddying for Ray Floyd at the Tournament Players Championship. On the 11th hole, there's a place where the caddies cut across to the fairway after handing the player his driver. It's a par 5 hole, and this caddy wants to check a yardage for a number into the green to lay up on the par 5. First off, you wouldn't be doing that. That's the stuff you should be doing beforehand. So this leads into what happens next. He lays Floyd's bag up against and behind a big tree so that should an errant shot come, it can't hit his player's bag and incur a penalty, which at that time it was a penalty. As he was walking back from checking the sprinkler head, Ray Floyd is on the tee in the process of hitting his tee shot. The caddy sees that a well-meaning marshal has taken the bag from behind the tree and laid it down in the landing area in the rough with the open club head part of the bag facing the tee. Floyd's tee shot starts right toward his bag, and now the caddy is running to try and beat the ensuing ball from hitting the now laid down bag. But of course, it hits it and rolls right up and into it. So... not so good. So, yeah, that's why caddies need to do their homework. Another one.
Volunteers, just quick.
Yeah, you know what?
Volunteers. You do great things when you're volunteering at the tournament. Just do what you're told to do, which is hold those stupid things and point at the trees where no one's there, and just don't do more. Do less. Do less. Do less.
Yeah, you're probably right. They tell you to just do your job for a reason, right?
So. Just do less.
All right, last one here. Another European Tour one. An event at the Forest of Arden, a player named Raymond Russell, he was on the 12th hole. He tossed his ball to his caddy quickly after marking on the green. Now, we know caddy now, you try to pay attention to your player as much as possible, but sometimes you got a lot of things going on, so you're not necessarily looking at them. This time, he wasn't. So the caddy didn't know it was coming, nor did he have enough time to react and get the ball got past him and landed into a greenside lake. After the allotted time, the caddy had pulled out 9 golf balls, none of them his players. And since the rule is that you must complete the hole with the same ball with which you started, he incurred a 2-shot penalty. Russell's post-tournament comments were that the caddy should have caught the ball.
Just so gutty.
that's such a player comment.
Such a diva comment. Unless you're joking.
Yeah, but exactly.
Like, just a diva. That's hilarious, though. I think I think you actually find video of that somewhere out on YouTube.
Oh, probably,
YouTube,
so. Yeah.
That is amazing. We have many more stories. So why don't we hit it off by going all the way back to episode 1, sitting in my basement with a round table with Ryan DeVoe, and talking about, you know, bad places he stayed over the years, and a particularly bad one just outside of Notre Dame, I believe. If you haven't heard it, here's your chance now. And I recommend going back. Great episode with Ryan. But here's a story about Ryan Dez almost, you know what? I'm not going to give any more details.
Where's the craziest place you've stayed in while on tour?
I know there's a story you're going to tell because you told it to me when you were in like Indianapolis. Yeah, it was like you were a Symetra tour.
Symetra tour.
The first year I caddied on the Symetra tour with Augusta, we would typically stay in housing with the tour. She was nice enough. We were good friends before golf and stay with me, you know, whatever. But this one week in South Bend, Indiana, or whatever it is. I don't know. The States. Whatever.
Yeah, it was between...
Where Notre Dame is.
South Bend.
So I am staying in this, like, pretty crappy hotel, and, you know, it's $250 for the week. Pretty sweet. And
people live there full time.
Yeah. So I'd gone to the college bar on, like, the Monday or Tuesday with a couple of the caddies, and the bartender there was like, hey, like, me and a couple of my buddies are going out on Thursday or Friday or whatever, do you want to come with me? And I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, got his number and we were going to go out with all his friends. So the night, that Friday, I am going to go out and just end up passing out, you know, 10 or 11 at night, right when I was supposed to go. Wake up the next morning, 8 o'clock, to go for the McDonald's or something, I think it was, right beside our hotel. I go out and put my glasses on and I'm like, why is there a cop car outside my door? And then I was like, why is there 4 or 5 cop cars outside my door? So I, like, take my key, shut my door. I go around the corner, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, that is, like, a SWAT van or something. So this big black van's there, and then all of a sudden this cop comes up to me and, like doesn't tackle me, but he's like,
Excuse me, sir, are you Ryan DeVoe?
Yeah. And I'm like, no, I'm Scott McCloud. I'm here writing an article.
Do you make green books?
Yeah. We're looking to buy 3. We heard you're our man.
We want to double your sales.
Yeah. Oh, the greatest day of all time. Not this isn't actually though. So then, like, he, like, gets me, you know, don't come past this yellow line. And I was like, what's going on, man? He's like, what are you doing here? And by this point, I look back besides the cop cars, and I'm the only car left in the hotel because it's like 8 or 9. I guess everyone had heard this going on last night or whatever. And I was like, what happened? And he's like, we can't tell you. And I was like, what happened here? Like, I'm staying here till Sunday. And he was like, well, there was a murder last night. And I was like, for real? And he's like, yeah, dude. Like, he wasn't pumped about it. Like, I mean, bro. Yeah. Murder. Like, Ja Rule. Who was that? Murder. Ja Rule. And he was like, yeah, there was a murder or whatever. You know, obviously this isn't funny, but he's like, it had been a drug deal gone wrong where they got in a fist fight. The guy was on the ground and he, like, drove over him and killed him.
Pretty sick.
And I was like, I was like, I'm going to go check out. He's like, good idea. So I go check out.
Extra 25 bucks.
Well, obviously, you know, my appetite was a bit taken away, but I still went to McDonald's. I was hungry. So I go to McDonald's. I get the two things or whatever, the breakfast sandwiches, come back to my hotel, shower, you know, pack my bag, come out. I come out of my hotel room. And like I said before, I was still the only car there. And there was like the two or three local camera crews that were still there. And they were like, hey, can we like interview you? And I was like, no, not interested. And I was like leaving. And I was like, I was single at the time. And the one girl was pretty cute. And she was like, can we please have an interview? And I was like, all right, give me your business card so I can see the interview. So yeah, huge mistake. So I do this interview. It was like a bunch of random questions. You hear anything? You know, blah, blah, blah. So I go to the golf course. We play our round, tell a couple girls about it, go to my new hotel. Come back the next day, and like all the players on tour were like, you were involved in a murder. Like, what is going on? And I was like, no, like, but yeah, that was pretty crazy.
Just a classic story from Dez, and only Dez can get himself into a situation like that and still try to find a way to get a date out of it. This next one, we're going to go back to our buddy, Kyle Peppers, Kyle Peters, however you want to call him, and how missing a cut led him to quite the tab in Las Vegas.
Let's see, probably like my 25th birthday, I think it was. We were playing in Raleigh, North Carolina. And the first round, my player shot, I don't know, 3 or 4 over par. He was going to have a really, really good second round, like 600 or 700 to make the cut. My roommate was still one of my really, really good friends. He's not caddying anymore, but he was caddying for Jimmy Gunn at the time. They're in the same situation. So I told my buddy, I was like, hey, my birthday's tomorrow. If we miss the cut, I'm going to Vegas. So we did not play anywhere near what we needed to do to make the cut. Didn't really even sniff it, so kind of the whole back nine, I'm like, oh, you know, I guess I'm getting out of here, going to Vegas. And we were in the early late wave. So we're stepping off the golf course at about 5:30 p.m. to sign our scorecards and everything. My roommate was in the early wave. So they finished around noon when we were teeing off. So I had no communication with them the whole time. So I step off the golf course and we go to sign our scorecards. And I get a text message from Jimmy Gunn. And all it says is Vegas. So I call him and my buddy. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, oh, we're boarding a plane in Charlotte. We're going to meet you in Vegas tomorrow. And Jimmy had some sort of connection at Aria, some high roller guy that plays a ton, you know, like $50,000 a hand or something crazy like that. So I get to Vegas the next day, and they've got us in like the penthouse suite at the Aria Suites or whatever. And this guy has the room comped for us. Anything that we want, room service, champagne, any drinks, anything we want, it's all comped. All we have to do is sign the guy's name. We'll just call it John Diaz is the guy's name. So we're there for, I guess, 2 nights, and everybody's ordering everything. And they all know to sign the guy's name. And I had totally forgotten. The last morning that we were there, I think it was Monday morning, me and my buddy, I mean, the night before, we had ordered 15 bottles of champagne, and we wake up, and I'm like, hey, let's get breakfast, and we order, like, everything on the breakfast menu for the two of us, and so we leave, and we go over to Planet Hollywood, and we play some blackjack over there and kind of forget about the breakfast. We walk back in the room and I'm like, oh man, I forgot about this breakfast. So we eat breakfast, we finish off the champagne and everything. We fly out of there a couple days later. I don't know where we were playing the next week, but I run into Jimmy and Jimmy's like, did you guys stay an extra night? And I'm like, no, why? What's going on? He's like, there was like $1,000 charge on my credit card. And I'm like, I don't know, dude. That doesn't make any sense to me. So Jimmy looks into it more, and turns out we did not sign the name John Diaz on the room service receipt. So we were dinged for all the champagne, all the breakfast. And it turned out to be a $1,000 breakfast for my birthday. And I paid half to Jimmy. I don't know if my buddy ever did, but that's one of my funny stories from over the years was a miscut led to Vegas on my birthday and then $1,000 breakfast. So that's all I got for you.
We got another story here most recently from Aaron Crawford, who was down caddying at the RSM Classic. And, you know, practice rounds always have a lot of laughs. And here's a quick one from Aaron Crawford.
So recently at the RSM Classic in Sea Island, Georgia, Martin and I get paired up with Tyler McCumber and his caddy Jack for a Tuesday practice round. A couple holes in, we hear Tyler and Jack talking about air density, which of course Bryson has brought up a time or two recently. The rangefinder they were using had it, and it was interesting to hear some of the numbers they would come up with for certain shots. We get around hole 15 and the four of us are still joking around saying how we think it's a little ridiculous to be calculating the exact air density on the golf course. I mean, without doing it at most, we're maybe off 1%. And like, seriously, how important can 1% be? So Tyler and Jack have about 120 yards left for their second shot, and we can hear them adjust for air density. Tyler pulls the trigger, and sure enough, he dunks it. Ruined the lip and everything. So, yeah, it turns out Bryson's right like usual, and we should all be calculating air density.
Maybe Bryson is onto something. We'll never know. Or maybe we will. Who knows? Last couple stories here. Anthony Silvestro sent these in. Couple funny caddy stories as per usual. Thank you for everyone who sent these in. We love them all. So here's Anthony's stories.
Hi, Scott. This is my caddy story from the 216 late Women's Open in Calgary. A friend of mine was going to be there because he started working with Christy Kerr. So I arranged for a friend of ours to host us for the week. I signed up to be a local caddy, not expecting really to get a player. But I spent a few days with Brady and Christy walking the course and getting ready just in case. And it was late Wednesday and I still didn't have a player. And by late that afternoon, I received a call from the caddy organizer. And he had mentioned that a player just got into the tournament, was looking for a local caddy. And I was basically the only one still around, so they offered me to caddy for her. Now, I walked the course with Brady for a few days, but I missed the tee shot on the 10th hole. And as it turns out, that was our first hole on Thursday. But when I checked my notes that we had made, and the 10th hole at Prittis Greens was a downhill blind tee shot. And the notes that I had for that hole was aim for the gap. It was a gap in the trees, and that was our aim point. And when we got to the 10th tee and my player was up first, she asked, what is my aim? Where am I aiming? And I said, aim for the gap in the trees. And we both looked up, and there were two gaps in the trees. And she said, which one? And I guessed and said the left gap, and it turned out to be the right one. But that was a fun week in Prittis Greens, a great facility, and we had a lot of fun. Hey, Scott, I have another caddy story for you. It's from the 2019 Canadian Tour Championship at the Highland Country Club in London. And I was caddying for a guy named Ryan Snelfer from the States, and we didn't have a great week. So we were always early tee times every day, and on the very last day, we were in a twosome right behind a solo player. So that term is called chasing the rabbit. And I forget who our playing partner was, but they were joking around with the officials, asking if we could play music during our round and things like that. And then they said, what's the quickest a twosome's ever played on the Canadian Tour? And the officials really didn't know. It's something they probably don't keep track of, but I'm sure we have, you know, start times and check-in times when you hand in your scorecard. So the guys really wanted to, you know, beat the record if there was a record. So we decided we were going to, you know, run down the fairway. And on the first hole, we lost a ball. So that gave us, like, added a little more time to our round. But if you're familiar with Highland, it's an old country club where the holes kind of run side beside each other. So there were a bunch of holes where we'd hit our tee shot, run out to the fairway. A player would hit his approach shot to the green. I'd give him his putter and whatever club he needed on the next hole and a towel. Then I'd go run over to the middle of the next fairway, or the, you know, in the rough of the next fairway, and basically meet him halfway. And I would always, you know, jump ahead and make sure I was always ready for him when he was ready to hit. And we were making great time. And the guys actually were playing well. It was probably the best round we had all week, even though we were, you know, running the golf course. And when we got to 18T, the solo player in front of us was on 18 green. So we literally finished just a couple minutes behind the solo player. And I think we played inside of 2 hours and 15 minutes. So that was two players and two caddies just like running down the fairway. So that was a lot of fun, but it was a painful way to spend Sunday morning. But we had an early tea time, and I think I was on the road by 11 o'clock in the morning going home. So that was a lot of fun. That was a cool caddy story.
Thank you to all the caddies and players that sent in those stories. We really appreciate those. They're all great. Lots of laughs in there, and these are the guys you want to go to a bar with and have a conversation with. If everyone thinks it's the players, go with the caddies. Those are the guys that are going to tell you the good stories.
That's why we have them on the podcast, right?
They're way more relatable too, right? Yeah, like true. To us, you're average right. Joes, right? They're way more relatable. Well, to keep with the tradition of, you know, the Looper episode, we have a full birdie versus bogey Looper edition. So let's hit birdie versus bogey and come up with our thoughts on each different caddy inspired option. So why don't you take it away?
All right, let's start. Number one, birdie versus bogey, caddies attending the flag from off the green.
Oh, definitely a bogey. It's such a tour sauce move from, you know, the guy that does it all the time is Phil. Everyone, you know, seen it. I think he did it from 50 yards one time, which is just stupid. It's a bogey. It's a hero move. Like, no, absolute bogey.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I don't even, you know, every time that I see it, I wonder why it's happening. I mean, in essence, anything that's coming from off the green is usually going at a pace that probably the flag might help. I don't think it's really necessary. So yeah, we'll just leave it at that. Just plain bogey. I know it looks like a baller move, but if you can't pull it off, I mean, if you don't hit it close, you're just going to look like a fool. So why bother anyway? So, all right, on to the next one. Caddies reading putts with their feet, aim point. I mean, I think I know where you're sit on this, maybe, but maybe I don't.
Here's how I'll say it. I will give it a birdie if we get rid of green reading books. All right. I think caddies should come in. I believe they help with green reading speed. And if that's the way they read greens, awesome. Why not?
Yeah.
But if we have this plus the green reading books and all that stuff, I think it's just almost too much. And I think we're taking a little bit of the skill out of the game by doing it. But I'll give a birdie, you know, it's a birdie if.
Yeah, then, yeah. 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 I mean, you know, there's no pars here. We've always said that before. So I've got to lean towards the birdie side. I'm not worried about, you know, extra footprints or anything on the green. I mean, you know, the caddies there to help. people might not like to see it, but you know, it happens. If it got to the point where obviously, you know, there was an excessive amount of time that it was taking to happen, you know, as far as the them green reading, then it might be an issue. But for now, we'll just leave it out of birdie.
The best story though is the reason this probably came up is Austin Johnson does it all the time on Dustin's putts.
Yeah.
And someone asked Dustin about it one time and Dustin was like, yeah, he does that. I don't know what he's doing. I don't, you know, he thinks he's doing something, but you know, I kind of don't listen to him anyway. So I just like the idea that Austin probably thinks he's reading all these greens every single time and Dustin just doesn't care to tell him not to. I'm sure he actually does help and Dustin's just ribbing his brother, but I thought hearing that quote, like, I don't even think he knows what he's doing, which might not be untrue.
Yeah, hard to say, but hey, it's working, so go with it. All right, next one here. Caddies switching out heavy bag for a light one at resorts. And I've been to lots of places where, you know, maybe it's Cabot or Pinehurst or something like that. You'll see a guy show up. He's got his nice, shiny golf bag, you know, the one he's spent all his hard-earned money on. And then, you know, it may not be some big, massive tour bag, but all of a sudden, you know, the resort caddy is all of a sudden taking his bag, putting it aside, pulling out, you know, a few gloves and a, you know, a few balls or whatever, a few tees, and then puts it in some lightweight bag and carries it. Birdie or bogey?
I'm struggling with this one.
Yeah,
this
that's a tough one.
You know, I'm pro caddy, but I'm also pro customer experience.
Right.
So
yeah.
This is really hard. I'm going to say it's a bogey. I think it's part of the gig. I think you want to make, you know, a tip. You're going to have to carry that heavy bag, and hopefully that person's aware. And if they aren't, you can make some jokes about it. But, yeah, taking it out, you know, don't touch my stuff. I would hope people don't do it, but people do. People have those stupid, you know, staff bags when they don't need it. I have a buddy that used to work in a golf shop, and there's always the guy that, you know, he had to have bag service, and he would call ahead, and you have to bring the bag out and have to be on his push cart ready to go. And this is not a high end golf course by any means. And this guy's bag was so heavy, and you had no idea. So one day, he's like, you know, this is probably my last day. I don't care. I don't care if I get caught. I'm going through this bag. What the hell is in this bag? And he said this guy had 12 dozen boxes of Pro V1s in his
bag.
Shut up. Bag.
12 dozen. 144 balls.
Yes, of Pro V1s. And he only used brand new ones. And he played a golf course where you shouldn't be losing that many golf balls. And he was just so mad about it. He may or may not have taken a dozen. That's how annoyed he was as a tip for the years. I'm not condoning that. I got to give it a bogey, though. I want to give it a birdie. I want to, but I got to give it a bogey.
Yeah, I mean, you said a what-if situation for the last one. I'd say, you know, if you get to a resort and you get to a place where all of a sudden they're short on caddies, or you've hired them and said, hey, we just want to have one and he'll double bag, you know, that's your choice as a guest. And if that's the situation and, you know, they change out the bags as a result of that and do a lighter bag, I can see that. But if you're going to, let's say, Pebble Beach, and you're paying $500 to play Pebble Beach, US, and that's not even what the tariff is, because you're going to have to stay at the hotel and the whole deal or whatever, you're there for the full experience. And chances are you're paying this caddy a good chunk of change. Plus they're expecting a good size tip, which we'll get to in a minute. You know what? If it's 10 more pounds, loop it, take it. I mean, really in the end, I think the caddies would probably end up making more money out of it because they're going to be out there doing it. And like I said, if the player has spent a lot of their own money and maybe it's their staff bag and they want a picture with it too, you know, while they're out on the golf course, their friends are going to know, hey, that's my bag. And, you know, the whole deal, you know, if they're carrying this little lightweight, you know, carry bag or whatever, I'm just going to give it a bogey. Yeah, I think, like I said, if it's a case of they're double bagging it, that's fine. But otherwise, no, I think.
Reminds me of that commercial Ricky used to be in, like, can you give me a 7? He's like, no 7. Give me a 6. No 6. What do you have? 5 iron?
Yeah.
you know, just hand me the five iron. Like yeah, that old commercial. Just a great commercial, by the way.
Yeah, and I think the customer wants to feel like a tour player, yeah, right? When they're playing Pinehurst Number 2, they want to feel like a tour star. Mm-hmm. And they're probably going to do it once in their life. So I think it just adds to the experience. All right, on that same vein, a caddy asking for more money than agreed to after the round. So what happens for most people, if you're not aware, when you go to a resort, there's usually a set fee based on the level of the caddy. And then after that, you know, maybe at the start, you might negotiate with your caddy and find out what the usual tip is and whatever the case may be. You're going to pay that based on probably the level of the service. But it's very common to see caddies trying to shake down players for more money afterwards. Birdie or bogey?
Oh, it's an absolute bogey. And again, it's part of the deal, right? You get paid what you get paid, and there's a risk. We talked about it with Scott. There's a risk for going out on the PGA Tour. There's a risk to do that job, you know, at St. Andrews. You know, and I think the, you know, when we go back to that situation with Matt Kuchar in Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Though Matt was in the wrong when you win, right, that he should have given more than the agreed upon thing.
But
the
that
caddy
was the
agreed also
upon.
Agreed upon that thing. They're both in the wrong on that situation. Yeah. And, you know, who is sadly technically more in the wrong is the caddy. He agreed to a contract.
Yeah.
He agreed. So, and that, I think that's the exact same way anywhere else. If anybody ever asked me for that, well, you know, you're getting, you know, right what we agreed upon, nothing more. And you might even get less because that's just, that's bad.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've seen it before. You know, I've usually probably not seen it out. I mean, it's hard to tell, but I mean, you know, good quality caddies are probably not going to be doing that. But I have witnessed this at a couple places where all of a sudden caddies are trying to chase people down in the shop afterwards and saying, hey, I've got this going on or whatever. And, hey, a little bit more money or whatever. And I've actually seen it even in St. Andrews, actually a couple of caddies trying to squeeze a few dollars out of their players at the pub. I think they just needed it for their next Bellhaven or their tenants. But it's kind of bad manners. So I think it's a bogey for sure. All right. Last one here. Caddy blocking a player from hitting a shot over a club dispute. I don't know if you've ever seen this before. I may have witnessed it once or twice, but birdie or bogey, good form, bad form.
I think your story is the important part. I think this is an easy layup. Let's just say Bowens used to get one a year where no matter what he said, Phil could not hit that club. And Phil had to listen. One a year. And if that's Bowens, who is probably the most recognizable caddy potentially of all time, I'm going to give him top five out there. Then, you know, you out on the McKenzie tour with your guy, you know, is silly. So I'm sure you're going to give it a bogey too. So instead of doing that, just tell your story.
No, I mean, I've actually seen it a couple situations or whatever, but, you know, it's birdie versus bogey in different situations. Usually if it's somebody that you know and you've got a relationship with and you've sort of agreed to that in advance that, hey, you know what, pulled me off, if anything, then I can see it happening. But if it's not a player that, you know, you work with regularly, it's a bogey move for sure for a caddy to go and do that. And my one story out of that one that I will tell was a guy who was a daily caddy on the McKenzie tour. And first off, the caddy was late, which is, you know, a death knell. He probably should have got fired on the first tee. Didn't rake very well, depended on the rest of the group to do his rakes or whatever. And then literally was five holes into the tournament on a par three and pulling a guy off by standing in front of him and saying, no, that's the wrong club. You've got to hit this. So that's out of bounds. You just don't do that, especially if you're just a daily looper. Different situation if you're Bones and you've got a veto to do that. So pure bogey for me.
Well, that's it for birdie versus bogey this week. You know, always fun to do that. It's exciting. And, you know, it was fun. I enjoyed it. Caddy edition. You know, a lot of caddy stories this episode. The Looper Show, as we'll call it. I think I've called it five different things. Who really matters? let's wrap it up with the mailbag, Scott. And then we'll hit the tip of the week and wrap up this fun episode full of laughs.
All right. Got a few questions in here pretty quickly this week. Thank you for everyone for sending those in. First one that came in, are there Canadian golf stories and content that you feel aren't being told? So you know what? Here's two ways to think about this. I can present it more from a journalist side of it. You present it sort of from the average golfer side of it. And, you know, let's hear your take.
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe I'm biased. I know we give them some love on this podcast often, but you know, what Aaron Cockerell's doing this year out on the European tour for me is the story. This guy, I don't even know if he kept his card on the McKenzie Tour in 2018, missed, I believe, almost all the cuts.
Yeah,
he made like
he did,
two
actually.
Cuts or something like that. Yeah. So he would have missed it, decides to go to Europe, which is a very rare route to go, you know, plays on the Challenger Tour out there, ends up getting his card, plays on the European Tour. And this guy has multiple top tens this year, having, you know, living it good out there on the European Tour in a year that's been extremely difficult to do that. You know, because of that, his girlfriend's looping full time and he's just playing well and he's enjoying it. He's got all the game in the world. He's young and could you see him out on the PGA Tour? Absolutely soon. And hopefully he does make his way back overseas at some point. But if he doesn't, you know, not a lot of Canadians. He's one of two, and I'm going to put it in brackets, Canadians out there on the European Tour. And the other one's not even playing right now in Austin Connolly. So you just, you know, give some love to the guy that's, you know, making it harder out there, much further away from home in a year that it's already difficult to see friends and family.
Yeah, I'm sort of going to be on that vein. I'm probably going to be a little bit more general with it, but I'm sort of biased because I've been involved a lot with regional media over the years. But I think part of the problem is what exactly you're talking about. You know, a lot of people now all of a sudden know who Aaron Cockerell is, because other people are starting to talk about him because he's doing something on the European Tour. But Aaron Cockerell is like many of the guys that we've had on this show, like Caleb Gorban, for an example, or, you know, some of the different players. There's a lot of stories that are out there. And I think the problem is that everybody gravitates towards the story that is popular, everybody knows about, and, you know, they'll get more clicks out of that. Right. It's a lot harder as a journalist these days, or some of the younger journalists, to go and write about something that's not popular right now. Go find, you know, the next Brooke Henderson when she's 10 years old. You know, don't find her now. Everybody's going to cover her on the tour. Right. You want to find all those other players. And I think Canada is a broad country. United States, obviously, a huge country population wise. Across the regions, every country, there's lots of stories happening at a regional level, club level. Again, they might not be the most exciting. Not everybody's going to read them right away. But I tell you what, 10 years down the road, when that player is super successful, you're the first person in, you've told their story, you found their interesting story, which may not be just their skill on the golf course. It may be something else about them. That story becomes really, really interesting. So I think in Canada, we've got over 3,000 golf courses, or 2,400 golf courses, sorry. Every place has a story. Every players have stories. So there's a lot more that are out there. We can't just focus on the headliners. And that doesn't matter if you're the associations across the country, national associations, whatever. Golf in Canada is not about 20 players. Golf in Canada is about 5.8 million people that play golf. And that's really what it's about. So yeah, are there untold stories? Yeah, there's tons. People just have to go out and find them. And yeah, that's all I'll say about that. How's that?
Yeah, just a few words there.
Yeah, just a couple. Anyways, we'll move on. All right, someone said, should I act now and buy end-of-year clear-out clubs or wait until 2021?
Yeah, I think it depends on you what you're doing over the winter, assuming you are in Canada or in an area where you can't hit golf balls all winter. So if that is the case, you're not going to be hitting much or at all, do it now because you can go get fit. You'll probably get a little bit of a discount if you don't care about getting the new stuff, which you probably really shouldn't care that much about getting the new stuff every single year. You know, fitters going to fit you for what you brought that day. So I would recommend it. But if you are going to hit all winter long and you have a little bit of an extra budget, golf clubs are only going to get more and more expensive. So yeah, wait till the new year, get the new stuff. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm on that same vein. I mean, you know, if something is affordable for you now and within your budget, then, you know, treat yourself, whatever you want to do. You know, it's going to make you feel good about your game. If you're looking to have a little you know, more value and buy a clear out, then buy a clear out. But don't worry about it for the fact that it's this year. And, you know, clubs are progressively going to get better with new features, but it's no different than a computer or a TV or anything else. It's still going to get you around the golf course. Chances are you're not going to all of a sudden find 20 extra yards because a golf club is out in 2021 versus 2020. As you said, getting the proper fit, going through that process is probably better. And it's actually, you know, it's probably wiser to go through that now than all of a sudden jump into the start of the year and then you get overexcited. And I've got to have that because everybody's got to see me having that. And I've got to get that 2021 one. And then some people will all of a sudden just jump in and buy it off the shelf and not get it fit properly. So, you know, just think about your budget. Think about what your goals are and fit the club to what you need to do. It's a tool. That's it. So don't get caught up with anything else. All right, this one is an interesting one because I had a couple in chats this week that were related to that. But do you think the longer shaft trend for drivers will reach into the public more in 2021? And obviously, we're talking about, you know, Bryson, Phil, I mean, Brooke Henderson, there's a lot, Adam Scott, there's some players that are playing 46 to 47 and a half, you know, 48 inch USGA, which is really about 47 and a half inches, lens shafts out there. What are your thoughts on that one?
I don't. I think the reason those people do that is because they're the best in the world and they can, where you're a stiff and you should probably be playing a 44 inch regular shafted driver because that's what's best for you. You really won't get that much more distance or speed out of it. You're just going to probably be more inaccurate with it and find all over the club face. So I don't. This isn't a new trend by any means. Scott can go over the history of players that have played 48 inch and longer drivers and yada 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 and bore you to death like he did in his first answer. But
again,
I don't see it happening. And if it does, y'all are dumb.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. It's been recycled. We've seen a lot over the last 25 years. I don't even need to get into that. But that said, because it's a popular topic of discussion, it's getting a lot of publicity right now. As a result of it, people are going out and they're going to be demanding that from some of their fitters and things and going, hey, you know what? I've got the money. I want to try it, you know, whether it's good or not for them. So I know already in talking to some different manufacturers that we're seeing some of them start producing some lighter heads that can be put on heavier shafts. Some manufacturers in the shaft business that are looking at creating special editions and some longer stuff. Again, not mainstream stuff, but maybe a special type edition, you know, counterbalance shafts that can handle the longer length clubs. You know, it's sort of like one length stuff. You know, it's got a small niche in the market. We might see the trend. Is it a positive trend? No, I think you're right. People will all of a sudden find out that, you know, they couldn't hit their 44 inch driver in the center of the face. They're not going to be any better with the 48. So could be fun. It's a lark. Got the cash. Go ahead and do it. Will manufacturers try to tap into it, sell a few more clubs? Certainly they will, but don't expect it to last. All right, on to the next one. As people in the industry, will the PGA show, which is the PGA merchandise show, which happens annually twice a year, January in Orlando and happened in August in Las Vegas, will it be able to continue going after being virtual in 2021?
I think it will, and the reason why I say that is it's golf's such an industry on relationships and having something in your hand and feeling things and hitting and all that and you know, the stories. So I think it isn't a industry, you know, it literally isn't an industry that can be done completely online, right? Like as much as we want to believe, you know, you can play a round of TrackMan and enjoy it, you know, it's not the same. And I think that's the same with this. I think next year, whenever we are able to get into groups like that safely, though, I believe it happens in Florida every single year. And Florida pretty much looks the exact same right now, but not that that's smart or anything. So I do think they'll be back.
Yeah, I think, you know, just as it has over the years, it continues to evolve. I think right now manufacturers, some of the big manufacturers are not going to be hurt by this not happening as much for 1 year. They've got relationships with large databases of customers, their, you know, their pros, all sorts of things. So they're going to be able to, you know, execute it okay. But you're right. The PGA show, it's not really about products. I mean, most of the introductions are done kind of in the fall now anyways. PGA merchandise show is more of a people show. It's more of a relationship show. And certainly, you know, we can Zoom as many times we want, but it's way different than being in person. And, you know, I think people see that now. I mean, even just, you know, missing out on things like a handshake right now. You know, there's something to be said for that as far as that type of contact with people. So I think the show will continue. This where this really hurts right now is probably the up and coming smaller manufacturers, the ones trying to make a name for themselves, the one that don't have a, you know, they don't have a big database or anything. They're there to show off their wares and they're there to catch lightning in the bottle. And, you know, being at a PGA merchandise show where there's 42,000 people from the industry there, this is their opportunity to do that. This is where they showcase. So I think there's still a place for it in the business. Certainly, you know, we might see some manufacturers pull out and go back in, who knows? But in time, I think it'll return to being the relationship experience that it always has been. All right, last one here. What's something average golfers misunderstand about their golf because of what they see on golf telecasts?
Huh.
Wow.
That's, I haven't thought about that. I do think that, and you hear all the time, the first one that comes to mind is players on the PGA Tour don't make as many putts as you think they do. You just see all the ones that go in. They don't hit shots as close as you think they do. You just, you know, they top it. They all make mistakes. And I saw a tweet earlier about, you know, they don't always play to their handicap either, right?
And we
talked about Dustin Johnson earlier this year. I think he shot 80 back-to-back rounds, withdrew from a tournament.
Yeah, after the Memorial.
Things like that. It happens. They lose their swings too. So, you know, golf's a weird game. Happens the best of them. So just enjoy it. I think stop taking yourself so seriously because it happens to the best of them. You know, the best of the best that can happen to you. Just don't worry about it.
I think you're right. I think what happens is that there's an unrealistic standard set by the golf telecast and the fact that, you know, they're there to show what's happening in a compact amount of time. So they're going to show the highlights, you know, in the rare instance that, you know, a low light is entertaining, maybe a John Rahm shank or something like that. They'll show that. But again, it looks like it's an anomaly, but poor shots happen more often than, you know, you can imagine. And really, until you go and watch a PGA Tour event live and see that, and you see the poor shots, you see that, you know, they don't hit every wedge to 2 feet. It just doesn't really happen. And you start to realize that, oh, those averages with from 100 yards are more like 24 feet. Mm-hmm. Then you begin to understand that, oh, I shouldn't be putting my standard against that. And I see people come to the lesson tee all the time. They, you know, you ask them, how close should you be hitting this wedge? They're out there looking at a target on the range and they expect to be hitting every single ball right on that target. And, you know, they hit it 10 feet left or 10 feet right. And you're saying, hey, you hit that as good as anybody on the PGA Tour. And they're like, what? Really? I pulled that or I pushed that. So unrealistic expectations is the big thing. You know, dig into it. There's lots of great stuff out there. A lot of stats and things that are out there, but realize that, you know, they're human too. They're not robots. So don't judge yourself based on highlights of a golf telecast. Thanks, everyone. That was great. Good questions this week in the mailbag. Keep them coming. We'll reach out every week like we usually do on social media. And you can send in your questions. Keep them coming.
I love it. Well, that's it for the episode. But before we wrap it up, you know, still got to work on your game. So Scotty, why don't you give everyone a tip of the week to work on? Well, you know, snow's on the ground in most places in this country.
Yeah. Outdoor season's over for many. So you know what, this is a really good time to kind of assess a lot of things. A lot of people will assess their golf games, but assess your equipment as well. A lot of people, unfortunately, when I was in the golf retail business, and you'll know this as well from me in the retail business, the golf season starts at, let's say it's April 15th. They come in April 14th to get their regrips done. And they start thinking about their equipment then. They kind of pull them out of the basement and whatever. This is a great time of year to do an equipment check. You know, check those grips. Check to see if there's any shafts that are bent. See if there's any damage to your clubs. See if there's heads that are any loose, ferrules. Get a loft and lie check. I mean, people don't realize that even in cast golf clubs, the lofts and lies will change over time, which can affect, obviously, you know, the quality of the shots that you're hitting. So look at the groove wear. Do all your things that, you know, especially if you're going to work on your game over the winter, you want to make sure your clubs are ready for the winter as well, but you want to make sure they're ready for the springtime. Take care of it now. You won't have to worry about it. And if you happen to be a spouse, that's a good gift for someone, you know, who's a golfer that you're trying to find a gift for. Give them the option of a re-grip or something like that, a gift certificate to the shop, pro shop, whatever the case may be. Check out your equipment now. Make sure it's in good shape. Then you won't have to worry about it. And when the season starts again, you'll be ready to go.
I love it. Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you to all the caddies that sent in stories. Thank you, Scott, for all your tips. Thanks for joining me today.
Yes. nice to be here for the 93rd episode.
Longtime guest of the podcast. Thank you, Scott Martin. Thank you, everyone, for sending in their questions. We really appreciate it. We'll be back next week. I believe the PGA Tour is off this week, a little rare week off. And then they're in Mexico. So, nice to have a break. It's weird.
Yeah, and actually, you know what? We're lining up some good stuff, too. If you're working on your golf game for the wintertime, we're working on some guests, and who knows, that might be next week. We'll have a guest in to talk a little bit about preparing yourself in the wintertime. Maybe some of the things that you could be working on, be that, you know, physical, skill-wise, whatever the case may be. So stay tuned for that.
I love it. Well, as for me, it's time to hit the couch. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We appreciate it. Make sure you rate us 5 stars and subscribe. You know, I saw on there someone rated us 1 star. You know what?
Come on.
That's okay. That's okay.
Tell your dad that there's other podcasts you can listen to.
Yeah, if you don't like this one, Dad, go listen to one about how to get rid of the shanks. I don't know. All right, folks, that's enough of me. See you later, Scotty. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll chat with you next week.